a special recognition of a difficult task.
To enter and for full terms, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4/allinthemind. You have until 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 8th of January, 2025, to enter. Can't wait to read what you have to say.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of September. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
It is indeed. Good morning. The headlines. The United Nations has warned against any action that could trigger a wider conflict in the Middle East after 9 people were killed when pagers used by Hezbollah simultaneously exploded across Lebanon. More than 120 charities are calling for the government to protect the UK's foreign aid spending from cuts in next month's budget.
Also in today's programme, Sir John Major on the future of the Conservative Party and the policies it has pursued, which he didn't agree with, like the Rwanda scheme.
I thought it was unconservative and British, if one dare say it, in a secular society, unchristian and unconscionable. We used to transport people nearly 300 years ago from our country. I don't think transportation, for that is what it is a policy suitable for the 21st century.
For the latest in our listener series, where we look at issues brought to you, our listeners, we look at prevention of crime. We've been given rare access to a mental health support centre where they're trying to cut reoffending rates using therapy. And should supermarkets use artificial intelligence to move us towards healthier choices? The boss of Tesco thinks it might work.
I can also see it nudging you over time, saying, look, I've noticed over time in your shopping basket that you're sodium salt content is 250% of your daily recommended allowance. I would recommend you substitute this, this and this.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The United Nations says the simultaneous explosion of pagers used by Hezbollah in Lebanon marks an extremely concerning escalation in tensions in the Middle East. 9 people were killed and nearly 3,000 wounded in blasts across the country yesterday. Hezbollah has blamed Israel and promised to respond. Israel hasn't commented. The UK has called for calm heads and de-escalation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yulan Nell.
Already, fears were running high of a new escalation between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel's leaders have been threatening to step up military action to return thousands of displaced citizens from the north of the country to their homes after nearly a year of cross-border fighting sparked by the war in Gaza. Now Hezbollah has threatened retaliation for the latest dramatic, wide-scale attack. While Israel's military has declined to comment, international media quote unnamed US and Lebanese sources saying that Israeli operatives hid small amounts of explosive material within a new batch of pagers imported into Lebanon. This morning, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Egypt to discuss Gaza ceasefire talks. A State Department spokesperson in Washington said it was too early to say if the attack in Lebanon would affect negotiations, but insisted the US was clear that diplomacy was the way to reduce tensions.
More than 120 international charities have urged the government to protect foreign aid spending from cuts in next month's budget. In a letter to the Prime Minister seen by the BBC, they say reductions could leave aid spending at its lowest level since 2007. The Foreign Office said the government would return to spending 0.7% of national income on aid as soon as fiscal circumstances allowed. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
The annual foreign aid budget is about £13 billion, but in recent years much of it's been spent not on humanitarian crises overseas, but on housing asylum seekers in the UK. As a result, the Conservatives gave the aid budget a £2.5 billion top-up. But that was only for 2 years, and charities fear the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will not renew it when she announces her budget. In their letter to Sir Keir Starmer, 120 charities, including Oxfam and Save the Children, say that would mean damaging cuts to life-saving programmes. They urge the Prime Minister to keep aid spending at current levels, about 0.58% of national income, and spend less on asylum seekers' hotels.
President Biden has called on Sudan's warring parties to re-engage in negotiations to end their conflict, which began in April last year. A statement from the president urged the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces to pull back troops and facilitate humanitarian access. the chair of an inquiry into abuse at Brookhouse Immigration Removal Centre near Gatwick Airport, says ministers have only agreed to one out of 33 recommendations made in her report a year ago. The Home Office has insisted it is committed to ensuring the abuse that took place at Brookhouse can never happen again. Tom Simons reports.
The Brookhouse inquiry report detailed 19 serious incidents where detainees were abused by staff following an undercover investigation by BBC Panorama. There were 33 recommendations, but so far only one has been agreed. This involved making clear to detention staff that detainees shouldn't be handcuffed behind their backs when seated, which can lead to asphyxiation. Kate Eaves, the inquiry chair, said the response of the Conservative government had been inadequate and disappointing, and Labour also needed to show more commitment.
From today, junior doctors across the UK will be referred to as resident doctors. The union, the British Medical Association, said the change in title would better reflect their expertise. The American homeware brand Tupperware has filed for bankruptcy. The company has struggled to address a drop in sales and had earlier this year raised doubt about its ability to continue. According to an annual survey, sightings of butterflies across the UK have fallen to their lowest level in 14 years. Conservationists say the decline is partly because of an obsession with tidiness in gardens and across the countryside. More from our environment correspondent, Helen Briggs.
Those taking part in this summer's big butterfly count recorded an average of 7 butterflies in a 15-minute period. Last year, the number was 12. Butterfly Conservation says the figures are so alarming it's declared a nationwide butterfly emergency and is calling for a total ban on pesticides known to harm butterflies and bees. Neonicotinoids were banned in the UK in 2018 but have been approved several times for emergency use in farming. The government has said it intends to ban the use of neonicotinoid pesticides but has given no timescales for doing so.
Helen Briggs reporting.
Thanks very much, Jane. It is 6 minutes past six. I think it's a good time, as always on this programme, to get the weather forecast. Let's go over to Sarah Keith-Lucas at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Emma. We've got some dry, settled weather on the cards through the next couple of days. High pressure still holding on to our weather, and it's going to feel reasonably warm for this stage in September too. So something of a north-south split. Higher pressure keeps lighter winds in the north, where we've got a little bit more breeze blowing towards the south and a bit more cloud too. So for all of southern England, through Wales into the Midlands and eastern England, it's a mostly cloudy start to the day. We have had some clear spells. You may have been lucky enough to catch a glimpse of the partial lunar eclipse over the past few hours. But any cloud that you do have will tend to break up fairly quickly. So it'll brighten up through the day. Some long spells of sunshine. We'll just see a little bit more of that cloud just hugging the coasts through the Wash, for instance, down towards the far southeast of England too, where it's going to be quite breezy, the breeze coming in from the northeast. But top temperatures around about 21 to 24 degrees across the region. Further north across northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, to start the day we have got some mist and some fog patches around. They should clear away relatively quickly, so we're looking at long spells of sunshine, lighter winds in store here too, so it'll feel warm. Temperatures around 20 to 24 degrees, probably the warmest weather across western parts of Scotland. And as we head through the course of tonight, again, we'll see the cloud building, the mist and the fog like we had last night developing too. But tomorrow, another dry, settled day with cloud disappearing gradually through the day. More of a chance of some heavy showers, though, in the south towards the end of the week.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. Talk to you again shortly. It is 8 minutes past six. Let's have a look at some of the headlines in the newspapers this morning. The Middle East is holding its breath, according to the Daily Mail, after what it terms an astonishingly audacious attack on Hezbollah. The paper describes victims writhing in agony with hideous injuries when their handheld pagers exploded. The New York Times quotes American officials as saying that Israel intercepted a shipment of the devices, planted explosives inside them, and then detonated them with a message. The Financial Times calls the attack a humiliating blow to the Lebanese armed group, Hezbollah, that is, but it warns that it will heighten tensions. The Times reports that Hezbollah maintained it's prepared for war, but this latest attack could leave it wondering what else Israel has in store.
The Daily Mirror features an exclusive interview with the man it says sparked the downfall of Hugh Edwards. The 21-year-old who sent explicit photos to the former BBC presenter says he was groomed. He also expresses disgust that Edwards wasn't sent to prison after admitting having indecent images of children in a separate court case.
On its front page, The Sun says Edwards is just one of a growing number of online paedophiles spared jail. Its investigation reveals that such criminals got away with hoarding more than a million child abuse images without serving a single day in jail. The paper says the justice system must be rebuilt, demanding there are no more slaps on the wrist.
Sources tell the Daily Telegraph that the government is drawing up legislation which would allow water companies to raise their bills to help fund a bailout of Thames Water. The paper reports that under the plans, the full £10 billion cost of the intervention would be charged to firms, which would then be passed on to customers. But government insiders insist this would be a last resort.
In the Daily Express, campaigners warn of a disaster if the government does not restore the winter fuel allowance for all pensioners, claiming that many will die because they won't use their heating. In its leader column, the paper warns that the government is running out of time to avert a humanitarian nightmare. The Work and Pension Secretary, Liz Kendall, has told the Commons that the Household Support Fund has been extended to help pensioners.
Several of the papers give their verdicts on Sir Ed Davies' speech as he brought to a close the Liberal Democrats' party conference. The Daily Mail's sketch describes it as a gumbo of sentimental tripe, while The Guardian says the event was a happy place where money was no object and the NHS and the economy were as good as fixed. The I paper calls on the Lib Dems to show they can truly be a proper opposition, warning that their ship risks running adrift with no clear landing strategy in sight.
And the Times asks whether the UK should call time on the pint to reduce alcohol intake. The paper reports that a study by the University of Cambridge has found that beer consumption dropped by 10% when pubs replaced pint glasses with those two-thirds of the size. Sort of obvious, isn't it? You serve people less beer, they drink less. But drinkers in London who spoke to The Guardian weren't so keen on the idea, saying if you want to get drunk, it would just take six instead of four.
That's commitment for you, if you get that sort of conversation going as a journalist. It's 11 minutes past six. Could a much bigger use of artificial intelligence by one of the UK's largest supermarket chains nudge people to buy healthier food in their online shop? That's what the chief executive of Tesco has said is on the cards when talking about those customers who use its club card loyalty discount scheme. How feasible is it? What effect might it have on the UK's terrible obesity levels? Almost three quarters of people aged 45 to 74, just to give you one figure, in England alone, are overweight or obese, almost three quarters. Claire Barrett, consumer editor of the FT, joins us now. Just tell us what the Tesco chief executive, Ken Murphy, said. I believe it was at the FT's Future of Retail Summit.
It was, Emma, yes. Good morning. I mean, I asked him, if you're employing an incredible 5,000 people directly in Tesco's tech department, which is what he's doing, how are you going to use AI to change Club Card? Because it's the most popular loyalty scheme. 22 million households have it, handing over their shopping data in return for vouchers. And it gives the supermarket a really powerful position to influence what we buy for good or for bad. And he said if AI is looking at your shopping patterns and seeing how you buy, then theoretically there could be a whole host of applications in future to start nudging you. Now, it could be to save money. There's a product you buy quite frequently, but if you wait until next week it's coming on offer, I can see how people might value that. But then over time, he said, it could nudge people to say, actually, we can see from the products that you're buying that your average sodium consumption might be 250% of the national average, how much salt you're eating. And if you substitute this, this and this, then it could be better for your health and reduce your chances of heart disease.
I'm just trying to imagine it, because I actually did the online shop this morning coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's something.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, or part of it. Part of it. That's one of my roles in life. And I'm just imagining this message coming up, like, how, you know, in terms of how it would be communicated and whether you'd pay any attention to it at all.
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems with loyalty cards. When they give us promotions that are no good to us, for example, a vegan being sent a voucher to get money off sausages, for example, was one of the ones that came up at the conference, that annoys us. If we get lots of offers that are not relevant to us, spamming us, that annoys us. But on the flip side, if we get offers and suggestions that could be helpful to us, sometimes it feels a bit creepy. And I think that there's a whole spectrum here of consumers. There would be some people, like me, for example, older, trying to lose weight, trying to be healthier. I would welcome insights that might help me save money or nudge me, towards making healthier swaps. And certainly there are lots of people who are prepared to share their data with smartwatches to track their steps and get nudges to, you know, to be more fit and active every day. So that's definitely a movement. But the fear of surveillance and also what that data could be used for, the privacy concerns, whether it could ever be used against us in the future in terms of like calculating our longevity risk for health insurance or something like that. Of course, nothing that the chief executive of Tesco was talking about at the conference, but in consumers' minds, that's very much the fear that opens up, because at the end of the day, Emma, are the retailers investing in AI for altruistic reasons because they want to lower the nation's blood pressure, as important as that is? Or are they doing it to pump up their profits and sell us more stuff?
Well, either way, will it work? And we're going to explore that a bit later in the programme, but it's good to hear what was said and how perhaps it's being thought about, especially within the business world. Claire Barrett, consumer editor of the FT, thank you.
It's 6:15. More than 120 international charities have urged the government to protect foreign aid spending from damaging cuts as they see it in next month's budget. They've written a letter to the Prime Minister, which has been seen by the BBC. Let's talk to James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent. Morning, James. So, James, for much of the past 25 years, when you've been following this stuff, as many people have, aid was seen both as a kind of moral imperative, but also a form of soft power. That seems to be a view less and less widely endorsed in government.
Well, it suffered in recent years because it's been cut because of spending pressures in the Treasury. And the extra pressure at the moment is the fact that a large chunk of the aid budget is spent actually in the UK on basically on housing asylum seekers. And that has rocketed in the last few years. As a result, the Conservatives gave the aid budget a top-up, about £2.5 billion a year, over 2 years. The problem is that has just expired, and the concerns these charities have is that that top-up is not going to be renewed by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, come the budget in next month. And so that's why they're writing to the Prime Minister to try and put pressure on the government, say, look, you've got to act on this, because if you don't, it'll mean substantial cuts, to real life humanitarian and development pressures overseas. And the broader point they make is that if the government does do it, just going to your original point of your question, they say that the government will, if it doesn't restore this aid spending, then the government will turn up, they say, empty-handed at all the international meetings that are coming up. There's the UN General Assembly next week. There's the COP later on this year. If the government doesn't actually start topping up aid, then its international reputation will damage. Now, in response to this, the Foreign Office says, look, it is determined to try and restore order, it says, to the asylum system. And it also says it will restore, the government's committed to restoring spending 0.7% of national income. That's the long-term target of aid. But they say only when the fiscal circumstances allow. And that's the point. There's a tension here between the government's trying to restore its international reputation and the domestic financial pressures at home.
James Landale, really good to talk to you. Thank you.
It's 17 minutes past six. Yesterday on the programme, we spoke about high levels of sickness in the UK and how that's impacting the economy. And today, one report says our workforce is shrinking at the fastest rate since the 80s. Sean Farrington has more on that and the rest of the morning's business news. Sean, good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning to you, Emma. Yeah, this morning is the Institute for Employment Studies that's led a commission on the future of employment support, so big issue. And it's found that the workforce, so those available looking for work at the moment, has fallen by 800,000 since the pandemic. That's hit the size of the economy, it reckons, by £25 billion a year. Take into account tax revenues that would have been raised if that shrinking of the workforce hadn't happened, then it would be £16 billion higher in tax revenues. I've got Indri Van Heen with me, who's portfolio manager at Janus Henderson. Indri, morning to you.
Good morning.
We talk a lot about the size of the economy and a lot of chat at the minute about raising tax, where's spending going to come from. But looking at the impact the workforce, the employment outlook is having at the moment, and this report, I mean, how serious an issue is it that the UK has fallen behind like this, as the report says?
It is very serious because, you know, if we have a shrinking supply of workers, that means the capacity for our economy to grow without pushing up inflation too much, inflation being, you know, obviously the hot topic of the last few years, is much reduced. So that is why the government is trying to introduce supply side reform to get our workers healthier and potentially with the new employment reforms and workers' rights they're trying to bring in, it lure them into the market through more secure work. And that way, you know, the economic, the ability and capacity for our economy to grow without causing that inflation should increase.
The report, the authors, Tony Wilson, who's the Institute Director, said that the UK, just reading here the quote from The Guardian, was an outlier in the developed world where workers had returned to the labour market since the pandemic, often even in larger numbers than before the crisis. What's gone wrong here in the UK? And are investors reacting to the fact that the UK hasn't bounced back the way others have?
I can't tell you the specifics. I know that there has been a lot of waiting lists are high, and there's been a lot of people out of work due to long-term illness, and that is something in particular the labour market is trying to address. It is something that investors focus on, just, you know, the long-term sustainable growth of the UK and therefore the vitality of this market and whether or not they will try and invest here. But in the very short term, we are seeing labour market pressures ease, we're seeing vacancies come down, and we're hearing businesses are, you know, not struggling as much as they used to hire the people they want. So yes, definitely a long-term issue, but in the short term we are seeing an easing in the labour market.
I've got a couple of business leaders with me to talk investment this morning. I just wanted to check in with them on this employment environment at the moment. Debbie Wasco joins me, who is the founder and former chief executive of Love Home Swap, so that home exchange website business. She sold for £40 million back in 2017. Also co-chair of the Investment in Women Task Force. Debbie, morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you think the solutions are for this? The Employment Minister, Alison McGovern, talking in the Financial Times today, saying the welfare shake-up to target job centres spending less time policing the benefit system, more time helping people find work. For you, what's the crux of the issue?
Well, I've got two other thoughts for you, because my dog in the fight is women, and I'm here today to talk about the Invest in Women Task Force, which we're going to chat about in a moment. So two things to think about. The first is that women in the UK are not starting businesses and they're not getting funded for their businesses. And if women were able to start and scale businesses at the same rate as men, it could deliver a potential £250 billion to the UK economy. So not every person who's out of work is a budding entrepreneur, but my hope is that some might be. So I give you that. The second thing is that I know that there is a huge issue for women in midlife who are leaving the workforce because of their menopause symptoms. In fact, 10% of women actually do that over the age of 45. So when we look at brain drain, if we can address some of the gender issues that we are struggling with in the UK around productivity, around entrepreneurship, and around women contributing to the UK economy by getting funded, I think that solves some of the conversation that you're having today about the UK's fiscal pressures.
Thank you, Debbie. And I will talk to you in more detail in a moment about the numbers you've got this morning about the money raised by women-led businesses in the UK. I've also got Mike Eakins with me, who's the Chief Investment Officer of Phoenix Group, listed on the FTSE 100 long-term savings and investment company, oversees a fair bit of cash, almost £300 billion. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
How much are these workforce issues impacting the UK's ability to get investment?
Well, look, you know, economic growth is an absolute key priority for the government. It provides a path to greater prosperity and fiscal sustainability. And having a highly functioning and flexible and diverse workforce is one of the key inputs to getting that economic growth over the long term on a sustainable level. At Phoenix, we employ several thousand colleagues, and we are really proud to have a flexible approach to working. We are one of the first companies to put in place 10 days paid carers leave provided to help our colleagues provide support to someone who depends on them. And all of these initiatives really go into attracting and retaining the best talent in the UK economy. And that's across all ethnicities, all the genders and all the different age ranges.
Mm, interesting. And just on the wider view of investment in the UK, we've heard a lot of talk this week. You know, that the Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, warning that cutting public investment in the budget next month could damage the foundations of the economy, stunt growth. In the Financial Times this morning, the CBI Business Lobby Group saying that they think the government's approach for sorting the public finances can be done in a more positive way. The headline there, negativity on the economy is undermining the investment push. Do you think the government is being a bit too negative at the minute? Is that undermining your sort of desires to put money in the UK and others?
Well, look, the economic growth is an absolute key priority for the government. And Phoenix, as the UK's largest long-term savings and retirement provider, stand ready to play our part in delivery of this by investing alongside the government in key areas like social housing, clean infrastructure, clean energy. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the UK is a fantastic place to come and do business. And we are really looking forward to participating in the upcoming investment summit next month.
And I'm sure. Do you think, you know, we've got that investment summit, what's that sort of on the just a few weeks before the budget. So that investment summit is being held just before everybody's going to be finding out what's happening with potential tax increases. You know, the mood ahead of that summit, is the tone right from the government right now?
Look, we absolutely applaud the government in setting up this investment summit. What we would say to the government is they should be really bold in their thinking on what they want to achieve by bringing in domestic investors and non-domestic investors. But look, coming back to it...
What does boldness mean, just briefly, Mike?
Say again, Sean?
What does boldness mean?
Look, what we would call for is a pipeline of investable assets that the government will seek to implement alongside private sector investors, such as ourselves, you know, long-term savings and retirements providers and pension funds. So really coming up with that pipeline of investments across the different asset classes of social housing, infrastructure, energy, education.
Right, gotcha. Mike, thank you very much. Interesting stuff from Mike Eakins, the Chief Investment Officer of Phoenix Group. Let's get back to Debbie Wasco, who is the co-chair of the Invest in Women Task Force that's found the percentage of that money in the UK backing businesses, and particularly backing all female-founded businesses, has dropped to below 2% in the first half of this year. That's a fall from 2.5% last year. Debbie, when you look at the numbers here, you see that fall in the proportion, you see the total proportion that out of the £8 billion of private equity investment, for example, that's going towards male teams has gone up from 80% to 86%. Why is that happening, do you think?
Listen, it's a pretty depressing statistic, and I'm 25 years into my entrepreneurial career, and when I see that happening year on year, it shows that there's a lot of work to be done. The task force, which I co-chair, is an industry-led and government-backed initiative to create the largest funding pot in the world to back female investors with a mandate to back female-powered businesses, because we need to make the UK a better place, the best place in the world.
But why the drop?
To be a female founder. The drop, I think, is a pipeline problem and it's an investor problem. So 11% of all pitch decks are from all female teams, but they're just far more likely to not progress to investment committee stage. And that's because on the other side of the table, only 11% of senior roles in UK firms are held by women, and we make up only 14% of angel investors. The gender pay gap, Sean, just begets the gender savings gap. Women have got less money. And more often than not, as I'm fully aware, to succeed as a female founder, you've got to be really good at asking men for money. We need more women writing checks. And that's what the task force is setting out to do, to create a funding pot to support female investors to back female-powered businesses in the UK.
Right. And the wider investment environment at the minute, Debbie, because that clearly plays into it. You need the UK to be seen as a place for money to flow to, as well as businesses that are led by women. Do you feel like it is? We're selling it the best we can at the moment?
I'm thrilled that today the task force is being backed by our first female chancellor. And that's a big deal. It's great news. We're delighted to have her support and the recognition that backing women equals economic growth. If women were able to start and scale businesses at the same rate as men, it could deliver a potential $250 billion to the UK economy. But I'm pleased that you had Mike on before this. We need his help. We need the banks and the pension funds to put money into this funding pot alongside the British Business Bank to create a generational shift in the way that capital is allocated. Female investors are twice as likely to back a female founder as their male counterparts. That is a positive thing. But we need positivity. You're right. We need a whole scale shift and an incentive to put money into their hands, because backing women makes good economic sense. Let's not forget, women-led businesses, by the way, deliver 35% better returns than male-led businesses. And as a country, we've got a lot of ground to make up.
Debbie, thank you. Debbie Wasko there, the co-chair of the Investment in Women Task Force. Big thanks to Indri Van Heen from Janice Henderson as well. I'll be back after seven.
Look forward to it, Sean. Thank you very much indeed. It's 29 minutes past six. And time to say good morning to Carthy with the sport. Hi, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Liverpool started their Champions League campaign with what ended up being a dominant 3-1 win over AC Milan. Despite the Italian club scoring within the first 3 minutes, Liverpool manager Arne Slot was pleased with the way they performed.
Yeah, although it sounds weird to say that we started well if you concede two chances, but we took control of the ball from the start of the game. But except from the first 5 minutes where they had two counterattacks, I think we dominated possession and created chances by that as well.
And after over 40 years away from Europe's top club competition, Aston Villa's return was a victorious one. Unai Emery's side defeated Swiss champions Young Boys 3-0.
It's very, very important how we got it. It's respecting the opponent and playing, being responsible, the players, mature, organised and imposing through it the game.
Harry Kane scored 4 goals for Bayern Munich in their 9-2 win over Dinamo Zagreb. Kane becomes England's top scorer in Champions League or European Cup history with 33 goals in 45 games. That overtakes Wayne Rooney's previous record of 30. Well, tonight, Manchester City host Inter Milan, the team City beat to win the Champions League in 2023, and Celtic face Slovan Bratislava at 8 p.m. And there is a Champions League match of the day on BBC One at 10:40 tonight. It was a very busy night of football, with Manchester United beating League One side Barnsley 7-0 in the third round of the English League Cup. And there was an extraordinary penalty shootout, with Championship side Preston North End winning 16-15 against Fulham. All of last night's results are on the BBC Sport website. Glasgow has confirmed it will host the 2026 Commonwealth Games after a deal was backed by the Scottish Government. The Australian state of Victoria withdrew as the original hosts due to rising costs. The 2026 Games will have fewer sports and athletes, but Commonwealth Games bronze medalist Tamsin Greenway explains its importance for sports like netball.
The Commonwealth Games is so integral for so many sports. You know, coming from my background, netball, it's one of our key competitions. In year three of every four, we build up to the Commonwealth Games and then head into the World Cup the following. So, I don't think people understand the impact that has, not only on the court for the professional athletes, but also off the court in terms of the fan base, the audience and the growth of the games.
And Simon Easterby will take charge of the Ireland men's rugby union team on an interim basis for the Six Nations, while Andy Farrell is on sabbatical to coach the British and Irish Lions in Australia next summer. Farrell will remain in charge of Ireland for this year's autumn internationals.
Thanks very much, Carthy.
This is the shocking moment English football has been dreading.
My name is Moses Swebu, and I used to be a professional footballer, but then I got in deep with organised crime and became a match fixer operating in the English League.
A match fixing investigator has highlighted 2 matches he says appear to have suspicious betting patterns.
How honest are you going to be with me?
This is 100%. Join me for Sports Strangest Crimes presents Confessions of a Match Fixer. Listen on BBC Sounds.
You are listening to the Today programme on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. It's 28 minutes to 7, and here is Jane Steele with a summary of the news.
The Foreign Office has called for calm heads and de-escalation after at least 9 people were killed and thousands wounded in Lebanon yesterday in what appeared to be a sophisticated remote attack. Pagers used by members of the militant group Hezbollah exploded almost simultaneously across the country. Hezbollah is blaming Israel, which hasn't commented. The United Nations and the US are also calling for restraint. More than 120 international charities have urged the government not to reduce overseas aid in the budget next month. They say any such move would lead to damaging cuts to life-saving programmes. The signatories to the letter include ActionAid UK and Oxfam GB. Labour promised at the general election to return aid spending to 0.7% of national income when circumstances allow. The chair of an inquiry into abuse at an immigration removal centre says the government has agreed to implement only one out of her 33 recommendations. Kate Eve says unless more is done, it will be only a matter of time before new reports emerge of abuse at Brooke House near Gatwick Airport. The Home Office says it is committed to ensuring nothing similar can happen again. A senior judge has described as breathtaking the amount of money some local authorities are being charged by children's homes run by private companies. In one case, a home was charging £16,000 a week to look after a 14-year-old boy who was believed to be involved in selling drugs. The Department for Education says a new children's wellbeing bill will strengthen regulation of the sector. Banks and building societies planning to close branches from today have to carry out an assessment as to how that would impact communities and businesses. The change is aimed at ensuring that people have access to cash. Butterfly sightings have fallen to their lowest level in 14 years. Supporters of the charity Butterfly Conservation count the butterflies they see in their gardens, parks or countryside over a three-week period in the summer. This year they spotted just 7 on average per count, down almost half on last year's average of 12.
Jane, thanks so much. It's 25 to 7. 9 people, including a child, have been killed after what's been described as an audacious synchronised attack, which saw handheld pagers used by members of the armed Iranian-backed group Hezbollah explode across Lebanon. That's what the country's health minister has said. Iran's ambassador to Lebanon was among the 2,800 other people who were wounded by the simultaneous blasts in Beirut and across several other regions. Hezbollah, prescribed as a terrorist organisation by Israel, the UK and other countries, relies on pagers for communication due to the risk of mobiles being hacked. It has blamed Israel. Israel has declined to comment. There have been almost daily exchanges of fire across the Israel-Lebanon border since the day of the start of the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza after the attacks on Israel on October the 7th, nearly a year ago. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent. What do we know about who is behind this extraordinary attack? What can we say, Yolande?
Well, unsurprisingly, the Israeli military, the Prime Minister's office have declined to comment on this. But there's some interesting reports coming from the likes of the New York Times, from the Reuters news agency. New York Times saying that American and other officials briefed on the operation said Israel was responsible for the attack, that it executed it by hiding tiny amounts, really, of explosive material in each pager, with a new batch of pagers that have been made in Taiwan, imported into Lebanon. And a similar report from Reuters saying that these pages have been modified at the production level. The suggestions being that this was a plot that was really months in the making. And we know that back in February, the head of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, had warned in a speech that phones were becoming more dangerous than Israeli spies. He told members to stop relying on them for communications. And that's where we saw a switch to an even greater reliance on sort of low tech on these pages. In the reports that are circulating, it said that Israel had assessed that there was a relatively low risk of non-Hezbollah members being affected because such a small amount of explosive material was being used in the pages. The latest we're hearing is that Iran's envoy to Lebanon, originally said to be slightly injured, has been badly injured in his eyes, his sight's affected. And, you know, what was just stunning about this, it's not just the fighters of Hezbollah. This was across the territory where Hezbollah operates, across Lebanon. Also, some people affected, at least a dozen cases in Syria that we've heard about. And as we've seen in social media, you know, rank and file members, it seems, were out and on the pavement, in streets and on motorbikes, in their homes, in the supermarket, in a barber's chair even.
Yolanda, our Middle East correspondent, will have more on this story throughout the programme.
22 minutes to 7, let's turn to politics with Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry. Let's talk first of all about what's happening in Downing Street and with Labour this morning, because Angela Rayner and the business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, are seeing union leaders and business bosses. What's on the agenda?
Labour's make work pay reforms, which are arguably, I think, one of the most far-reaching parts of this new government's agenda, certainly one of the biggest ruptures with the previous 14 years of Conservative government. So these are the reforms which would, among other things, end what the government calls exploitative zero-hours contracts. And the question of when a zero-hours contract becomes exploitative is an interesting one. End fire and rehire, give day one rights to certain employees. Now, Angela Rayner and Jonathan Reynolds are having a meeting on this. What's interesting is that this meeting today will be joined both by senior trade union officials, but also from business figures from groups like the CBI, the Federation of Small Businesses, and so on. And the unions and those business groups have different approaches to this issue. Some of the business groups fear that this could damage investment. Obviously, the union groups are pushing for the reforms. In fact, in the past, they've worried that these reforms might be watered down. This isn't a crunch meeting, not expecting necessarily a big announcement out of it, but nevertheless, an interesting staging post in what I think will be one of the big stories of this fledgling government.
And Henry, also an unusual sight in British politics today, that of John Major unleashed.
To you, in an interview with you, airing later today, I believe. And it's a very interesting interview because actually, John Major, you know, after leaving Downing Street in a landslide defeat to Labour in 1997, was fairly limited in his political interventions. Then during Brexit, he became very exercised. He did not support Brexit, wanted a second referendum, and then has been fairly limited again. But here he is back. He's very critical of the Rwanda scheme that was pursued by successive Conservative governments over recent years. He told you it was unconservative, un-British, un-Christian, and unconscionable. I'm also very struck by what he says about where the Conservative Party should go next. He warns the Conservative Party, which of course is choosing its next leader at the moment, not to pursue Reform UK voters. He says the Conservatives lost 5 seats to Reform UK, but it would be fatal, in his words, if the Conservatives in essence merged with them. And he says the Conservatives lost far more seats to Labour and to the Liberal Democrats and should be thinking about that. I mean, John Major is the first in a line of no less than 9 living former Conservative leaders, and others of those would counsel the leadership candidates to go in a very different direction. It'll be very interesting what the eventual winner chooses.
Indeed. Henry, good to talk to you. Thank you.
20 to 7. All this week we've been hearing from you on key issues you would like the new government to pay attention to. And this morning, our listeners are clinical psychologists working in a Merseyside NHS unit, which is the only one of its kind. Their goal? Trying to cut criminal offending and reoffending rates using therapy. It's not an alternative to prison, but as one of our listeners, Dr. Lisa Wright, explains, they're trying to understand why people commit crimes in the first place.
When we look at the origins of offending behaviour, definitely with the people we see, it's come out of the way a person has adapted to childhood trauma. So if you imagine a child growing up in a home or in a care home where they don't feel safe, imagine them being beaten up regularly by a parent. A common theme that we hear is that as the child gets older and they grow bigger, there comes a day where they fight back.
Our Home Affairs and Legal Correspondent, Dominic Casciani, is the first journalist to visit the NHS Forensic Psychology Centre in Liverpool, where he did meet with our Today listeners, one of whom you just heard there. Dominic, you got access to this service. Tell us what they do, how they're doing it.
Yeah, it's really unusual, actually, Emma, because there is an awful lot of work across the criminal justice system to get therapy to offenders. It happens in prisons day in, day out. And in other settings in the community, so for instance, if somebody gets a community sentence and they need some kind of therapy to address their mindset and offending, that is often part of the package. What's really unusual about Merseycare's setup is that they have been trying to expand this into the space of dealing with people before they actually commit a crime. Now, that's very difficult to do, and they've started this program by looking at adapting the work they've done with sex offenders who have either been in prison or have finished a sentence, and trying to work with people who are at risk of committing sex offences. Now, it's pretty difficult to find those people because obviously not many people volunteer. But their research so far and their instinctive feel about what they're learning over this programme is that there is an argument to be had to expand this therapeutic approach into other areas of crime prevention, particularly around people who commit violent crimes but not sexually violent crimes. So effectively, that's their pitch when they came to the Today programme. They said, come and see us, listen to what we're doing in our arguments, because this is such an important moment for the country. We have prisons which are full and emergency leave has just been pulled to release 5,000 offenders early. Perhaps there's another way of looking at crime and crime prevention, which ultimately could be an awful lot cheaper in the long run.
Thanks very much for taking us a bit more inside that. Dominic Casciani there.
17 minutes to 7, our main headline this morning. The simultaneous explosion of pagers used by Hezbollah in Lebanon has been described by the United Nations as an extremely concerning escalation in tensions in the Middle East.
17 minutes to, well, 16 minutes to 7. The time just changed as I said that. But let me take your mind to climate change, because perhaps when we do think about it, we may only think about the immediate impacts, heat waves, droughts, floods. But in fragile nations, it can do more damage than that. Some analysts describe it as a chaos multiplier, as it can exacerbate existing conflicts by intensifying the competition for scarce resources. What can be done about it? Our climate editor, Justin Rowlett, has been to the war-torn East African nation of Somalia to find out.
This is one of the most dangerous countries in the world. We're in a convoy of white International Red Cross Land Cruisers with three guards armed with AK-47s. Somalia is the only place where the Red Cross travels with armed guards as standard. Camel herders, we come out into the dry scrub to meet, sing traditional songs to soothe their animals as they scoop water from a waterhole. We are here because climate change is disrupting the patterns of rain that have made the herding lifestyle, a mainstay of the Somali economy, possible. The country has just experienced its worst drought for 40 years, an event scientists reckon was made 100 times more likely by human-caused climate change. It left people literally fighting for access to water and to pasture, says Sheikh Don Ismail, a local farmer.
There's no respect if you don't have a gun. The herders who lead their animals into the farm stay back when they see my gun. They get scared of you.
For the last 30 years, Somalia has been experiencing a brutal Islamist insurgency, a civil war, and a whole series of regional and clan conflicts. It means local disputes like these can easily spiral into full-blown battles. And it is not just drought. Somalia has experienced terrible floods as well. The most vulnerable bear the brunt. Mothers bring their babies into a Red Cross hunger clinic in a port town in the south of Somalia. The UN estimates 1.5 million children under the age of 5 are acutely malnourished. This combination of climate change and conflict has driven 4 million Somalis, a fifth of the population, into vast makeshift refugee camps. There's little international help. People live in huts made from rubbish they've scavenged. They have to pay rent as well as for their food and water. It means there is a huge reservoir of people desperate for paid work. Like many men in the camps, Alima Ali Mohammed's husband and four of her sons have taken up the only opportunity open to them as fighters in the local militia.
They are rural people with no skills, so the only work they could get was in the army. They were desperate, and when you are without food long enough and your children are looking at you, you will do anything.
And it's not like climate change is the Somali people's fault. The entire country has emitted roughly as much carbon dioxide from fossil fuels since the 50s as the US has in the last 3 days. Yep, 3 days. But Somalia is taking action. We visited a power station moving over to wind and solar power. and training up a new generation of renewable energy engineers. I met entrepreneurs setting up new businesses, including a refugee woman who'd set up her own cafe in the camp. It is why Abdi Hakim Anti, the climate advisor to the Somali PM, is surprisingly optimistic.
Now, I don't subscribe to the notion that Somalia is unfixable. I think it's fixable, and it's showing a significant progress on pretty much every front that you can look into.
So there is hope. But with climate change turbocharging the conflict here, the country will need continued international help in the effort to make peace and to build resilience against our changing climate.
You can hear more of Justin's reporting from Somalia in the latest Climate Question podcast. You can search for that on any podcast app you use.
11 minutes to 7. The BBC's Sancha Berg has been doing very powerful, important reporting from inside the family courts for years now. And together with producer Katie Inman, she was the first, or they were the first journalists to report from Liverpool Family Court. They followed some two very similar cases, young teenage boys in care who have troubled backgrounds, are being drawn into crime, dangerous for them, dangerous for society at large, but no registered children's home will take them. So both those young boys are placed at very significant cost in unregulated and therefore unlawful homes. And Sancha and Katie heard evidence that those homes are not able to keep them safe. You might think that the high cost means they get specialist care, but no, that doesn't happen. And what's happened now is that the most senior judge in Liverpool Family Court has said the cost of private residential placements for children in care is breathtaking and unsustainable. Let's talk to Andy Smith, president of the Association of Directors of Children's Services, who joins us now. Andy, good morning.
Good morning.
This is extremely urgent, isn't it?
It certainly is. Most children in care are looked after by foster carers or in registered children's homes, but there are some who are placed, as you say, in unregistered settings when there are no alternative placements available. And there was some research done last year by The Observer and the Together Trust that estimated that around 700 children in the UK were in unregistered accommodation. So that is 700 too many. But there are occasions, unfortunately, where there's no alternative but to place children in unregistered settings.
Why is that happening, do you think?
I think finding the right home for children in care is becoming increasingly difficult due to the significant shortfall in suitable registered homes in the right locations. And that's particularly true for those children and young people with more complex needs, those requiring the higher levels of support. You know, most of the children have experienced abuse, neglect, trauma, or loss. So access to things like therapeutic intervention, mental health support that can make a real difference to them is often not available in a system that can't meet their needs. So essentially what we've got is a demand for specialist placements, which outstrips the supply. And private providers can be reluctant to accept children with much higher complex needs.
Isn't the truth that it's expensive looking after these young people in care? And if it isn't for, you know, journalists like Sancha and Katie and people like you, frankly, they're easily forgotten about. You know, it's extraordinary to think there are hundreds of people in this country who are children who are in unregulated and illegal homes. I think that would shock a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, placements in unregulated settings are never the first choice of councils, and it's a decision that is absolutely not taken lightly. I mean, the cost of funding bespoke packages is really high, and it runs into tens of thousands of pounds per week.
Per week.
And of course, that's significant impact on the public purse. But of course, we're most concerned about the impact on children. I mean, temporary solutions don't allow for that certainty, that stability that we need to start to work with children who have experienced abuse and trauma and neglect.
And that tens of thousands per week, which is obviously not going to be borne by the parents or the family of those people because they can't afford it, has that generally in the past been when maybe the system was slightly more effective and functioning well or better, has that cost being absorbed by local councils who themselves have seen their budgets cut?
I mean, that cost is essentially absorbed by councils. I mean, there may be some arrangements where the cost is shared with partners from health in certain circumstances, but essentially that's a cost that is absorbed by councils. And I think if you look more broadly at the costs of children in care in terms of placements, particularly in the regulated settings where the majority of children are placed. You know, most of these placements are privately owned and operated, which means they can pick and choose from the multiple referrals and they can set costs due to high demands. Right. And there's been, you know, some significant reports that have come out in recent times about the level of profiteering of independent providers of children's social care homes.
So, yes, and forgive me for interrupting, Andy. I was just going to say that's one of the points of Sanchez's reporting, which is online. Andy Smith, President of the Association of Directors of Children's Services, thank you. And yes, on that final point, if you are interested in this issue, please head to the BBC News website where you can see Sanchez Berg and Katie Inman's reporting on that very profiteering that Andy's talking about.
7 minutes to seven. On yesterday's programme, the Director General of the World Health Organization said the cost of Mpox vaccines was too high. Mpox, previously known as monkeypox, is a rare infection most commonly found in the parts of West, Central and East Africa, and the risk of catching it in the UK is low. But listening to that call from the WHO was Professor Sir Andrew Pollard, Director of the Oxford Vaccine Group at Oxford University, and he also chairs the UK's Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is your response to that call? What can we do?
Well, I think my first thought is that it's a clear message, but it oversimplifies the current situation, because clearly cost is a part of this. But a really important aspect is the supply. We have to have enough doses available that can be provided. And this requires the international community to say that they will purchase them, because no manufacturer produces the doses until there's a request for them. And clearly that is what's changing at the moment, is the funding needs to be available for purchase. Now, that's being addressed in an initial way by a number of governments donating doses. So you may have seen in the media that Spain at the end of last month agreed to donate about 500,000 doses, and the Canadians 200,000. The European Commission is rallying to try and also stump up some doses to donate, because a number of countries do have stockpiles. So from the UK perspective, I think probably the argument would be that we're the one of the largest funders of the Global Alliance for Vaccines, with from the Boris Johnson government, we pledged about £1.5 billion pounds to the Global Alliance for Vaccines. And one of the things that's done with that money is to purchase vaccines, including for Mpox. So I think when you look at the current situation, yes, it's expensive, and we do need the money to be available to purchase them, but we also need enough supply, and that needs the market to say we want the doses. And I think that's what's changing at this moment.
And how quickly will that change? I mean, and how urgent is this for those who don't know very much about Mpox?
Well, I think it's something which doesn't happen quickly, in the sense that once the pledges are there, you have to manufacture the doses. And this has been, you know, an ongoing issue through this year. And so the manufacturing is increasing. But my hunch is that it'll be much longer before there are a large number of doses available for those countries that are affected in Africa at the moment. And of course, it's in our interests, whether we're in the UK or any other country that may have imported cases in the future, to make sure that this current outbreak is halted. It's not just about donating to these countries which could not afford the doses themselves. It's also to try and stop spread and reduce the risk of incursions into our own country.
Just briefly, do you think we still have that urgency post-COVID?
I think we should do here, because this disease, although if it did arrive in the UK, is something which is containable. And we have a healthy population generally who would be able to tolerate the infection more readily. The problem where it's in those countries are affected is there are many malnourished children living in very crowded circumstances where there's a lot of spread, and that's why we're seeing children dying. So the urgency is, if we don't get doses into those countries in Africa soon, there'll be more deaths, and we won't be able to stem the yes. spread, which then presents the risk of it moving to other countries in Africa, or even to the UK.
And we're not necessarily post-COVID, but I meant the experience of that and on the vaccination programme. Professor Sir Andrew Pollard, thank you.
Just coming up to 2 minutes to eight, and Sarah's here with the weather.
Thanks, Samuel. Well, we've got high pressure driving our weather still, so a dry day ahead, and it's going to feel really pleasantly warm for this stage in September. Yesterday, Northern Ireland got up to just shy of 24 Celsius, and that's the latest we've seen a temperature that high in the year in 11 years. So today, across southern half of the UK, so we're looking at southern England, Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, cloud will break up, sunshine will break through, but there's a bit of a brisk breeze coming in from the northeast, and temperatures here 20 to 24 degrees. For the rest of the UK, that's all of Northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Some mist and fog patches will slowly clear away over the next few hours, and then long spells of blue sky and sunshine, light winds here, and it'll feel pleasantly warm, 21 to perhaps 25 degrees. Warmest spot probably northwest Scotland.
Sarah, thanks very much. Next week, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent Mariana Spring will be stateside.
It's election time in the United States, but this is social media's world. And the election is just living in it.
Accurate information about elections, unfortunately, is not as entertaining as false information.
Join me, Mariana Spring, as I uncover how life online is shaping American people and American politics.
None of us know what's going on, but we do all know that something isn't right.
Deepfakes, polarizing algorithms, hate and conspiracy theories.
To me, there's no other logical explanation. That entire thing was staged.
Why Do You Hate Me, USA starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Monday afternoon at 4:30.
Coming up in the next hour of this programme, Sir John Major counsels the Conservative Party, which he led for 7 years, not to move too far to the right.
We need the right wing. What we don't need is the far right. People who've attracted themselves to the right wing, who perhaps would be more comfortable in Reform UK than with us, so that we don't have these factional disputes within the party.
Yes, all that coming up. You're listening to Today with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of September. The headlines this morning. The United Nations has warned the simultaneous explosions of pagers used by Hezbollah in Lebanon marks an extremely concerning escalation in tensions across the Middle East. A group of more than 120 charities says it's deeply concerned the UK's foreign aid budget could be cut to levels not seen since 2007. And the chair of an inquiry into abuse at an immigration removal centre near Gatwick says just one of her recommendations has been agreed to by the government. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The United Nations says the simultaneous explosion of pagers used by Hezbollah in Lebanon marks an extremely concerning escalation in tensions in the Middle East. At least 9 people were killed and nearly 3,000 wounded in the blasts across the country yesterday. Hezbollah has blamed Israel and promised to respond. Israel hasn't commented. The UK has called for calm heads and de-escalation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
Already, fears were running high of a new escalation between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel's leaders have been threatening to step up military action to return thousands of displaced citizens from the north of the country to their homes after nearly a year of cross-border fighting sparked by the war in Gaza. Now Hezbollah has threatened retaliation for the latest dramatic, wide-scale attack. While Israel's military has declined to comment, international media quote unnamed US and Lebanese sources saying that Israeli operatives hid small amounts of explosive material within a new batch of pagers imported into Lebanon. This morning, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Egypt to discuss Gaza ceasefire talks. A State Department spokesperson in Washington said it was too early to say if the attack in Lebanon would affect negotiations, but insisted the US was clear that diplomacy was the way to reduce tensions.
The Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Gold Apollo, named by some sources as the supplier of the pagers used in the attack, has denied making the devices. From Taipei, here's our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
Police are now inside the Gold Apollo offices in Taipei, questioning staff and examining documents. The company itself says it has nothing to do with the attacks in Lebanon or the devices involved. Company founder Xu Qingguang told reporters his company had signed an agreement 3 years ago with a European-based company called BAC. He said it gave the company the right to manufacture its pager designs and use the company logo. We only provided brand trademark authorization, he said, and had no involvement in the design or manufacturing of this product. The identity of the company named BAC remains a mystery, with Gold Apollo unable to confirm where in Europe it is allegedly based. Mr. Xu told reporters he was extremely shocked about what has happened in Lebanon and that his company is also a victim.
Official figures just released show UK inflation was unchanged last month, staying at 2.2%. This is above the government's target of 2%. More than 120 international charities have urged the government to protect foreign aid spending from cuts in next month's budget. In a letter to the Prime Minister seen by the BBC, they say reductions could leave aid spending at its lowest level since 2007. The Foreign Office said the government would return to spending 0.7% of national income on aid as soon as fiscal circumstances allowed. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
The annual foreign aid budget is about £13 billion, but in recent years, much of it's been spent not on humanitarian crises overseas, but on housing asylum seekers in the UK. As a result, the Conservatives gave the aid budget a £2.5 billion top-up. But that was only for 2 years, and charities fear the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will not renew it when she announces her budget. In their letter to Sir Keir Starmer, 120 charities, including Oxfam and Save the Children, say that would mean damaging cuts to life-saving programmes. They urge the Prime Minister to keep aid spending at current levels, about 0.58% of national income, and spend less on asylum seekers' hotels.
The chair of an inquiry into abuse at Brookhouse Immigration Removal Centre near Gatwick Airport says ministers have only agreed to one out of 33 recommendations made in her report a year ago. The Home Office has insisted it is committed to ensuring the abuse that took place at Brookhouse can never happen again. Tom Simons reports.
The Brookhouse inquiry report detailed 19 serious incidents where detainees were abused by staff following an undercover investigation by BBC Panorama in 2017. There were 33 recommendations, but so far only one has been agreed. This involved making clear to detention staff that detainees shouldn't be handcuffed behind their backs when seated, which can lead to asphyxiation. Kate Eaves, the inquiry chair, said the response of the Conservative government had been inadequate and disappointing, and Labour also needed to show more commitment. Without it, and with independent monitors already warning of a rise in violence at the centre, she said it becomes a question of when, not if, such abuses will come to light again.
Junior doctors across the UK will from today be known as resident doctors. The union, the British Medical Association, said the change was a better reflection of the expertise of those in the position. The most senior judge at Liverpool Family Court has said the cost of private residential placements for children in care is breathtaking and unsustainable for local authorities. He was speaking after a hearing about a 14-year-old boy. More from our correspondent Sancha Berg.
Judge Stephen Parker said the boy was believed to be part of a County Lines drug network. He's in care, but repeatedly runs away, once returning to his children's home covered in blood. That unregistered care home was charging the boy's local authority, Cheshire East, up to £16,000 a week. No regulated home would take him. Samantha Derbyshire is the Children's Services Manager, responsible for the boy's care.
This is public money. This is your money. It's my money. And they are profiteering off our children without the experience, without the Ofsted regulations to go with it.
She told the court such high fees for care were now routine across the country for children with complex needs. Within 3 years, her council's spending on children's residential care has more than doubled, and she said it could force the authority into bankruptcy. The Department for Education said it was committed to cracking down on excessive profits in the sector, and the new Children's Wellbeing Bill would strengthen regulation.
The food container firm Tupperware has started bankruptcy protection proceedings in the US after struggling with mounting financial losses and a drop in sales. The company's chief executive described trading in recent years as challenging. Sightings of butterflies across the UK have fallen to their lowest level in 14 years. Conservationists say the decline is partly because of an obsession with tidiness in gardens and across the countryside. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner, who's also a keen wildlife photographer, has this report.
Small tortoiseshell, holly blue, even the humble cabbage white. Familiar garden species to many, but they've all just had their worst year on record since the charity Butterfly Conservation began its annual survey, the Big Butterfly Count, 14 years ago. It says more than 9,000 people who took part in the July and August survey reported not seeing a single butterfly during that time. With overall numbers down by more than a third on last year, the charity is declaring a nationwide butterfly emergency. This year's wet spring hasn't helped, but now the charity is calling on the government to ban neonicotinoid pesticides, which it says are lethal for butterflies.
The Princess of Wales has carried out her first work meeting since the end of her cancer treatment. The meeting yesterday was about her project on families and early childhood. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
The Princess's return to public life, after months away from royal duty, is being carefully managed. The meeting in Windsor was not accompanied by any photos or video. But it will be marked on the court circular, which records official engagements of the royal family. The meeting was about the Princess's early childhood project, the focus of much of her public work. It is another sign of her continued recovery and what Kensington Palace describe as a return to a light schedule of engagements. Last week, the palace issued a video of the Princess and her family, where she revealed she had completed her cancer treatment after what she called an incredibly tough year.
Daniela Ralph reporting.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past seven. Let's turn to that lead story. Exploding pages in Lebanon. At least 9 dead, including a child. Hundreds in critical condition. More than 2,800 other people wounded by the simultaneous blasts. Israel has not commented. The theory is that someone was able to infiltrate a new batch of pages recently delivered to Hezbollah. The New York Times and others, Reuters, are reporting that may have happened in Taiwan. The BBC has not independently verified that claim yet. Kim Gattis is the author of Black Wave, a book about the modern Middle East. She's a contributing editor at the Financial Times and The Atlantic, and joins us now from Beirut. Kim, good morning.
Good morning, Amol.
We'll get to the morning. Morning from London. We'll get to the politics and the theory and the context in a moment. But first, just where were you when this happened yesterday, and what kind of panic and chaos did you see engulfing the city?
I was on my way home from a funeral, actually. So it was emotion after emotion and trauma after trauma. It was really a scene of chaos across the city because people didn't instantly understand what was happening. We first thought there was one large explosion in the southern suburbs of Beirut, which is a bastion of support for Hezbollah, the Shia Iran-backed militant group. It then became clear that there were simultaneous small explosions everywhere. Then we started seeing CCTV footage from inside shops, supermarkets, etc., of these small explosions targeting people doing their groceries, paying at the counter, or driving on their moped across the city. And then for hours on end, the wail of sirens, the internal security forces asking people to get off the streets because traffic was overwhelming the city, hospitals were getting overwhelmed. It was really a national traumatic event. It was targeted in many ways because these pagers were in the hands of Hezbollah operatives, but they were going about their daily lives, and the impact on the city and the country, because it was from south to north to east,
yes,
was tremendous.
And what's your thinking, Kim, on who carried out this attack and why?
It's hard to see anyone else being behind this but Israel. And we are hearing reporting now that the Israeli defense minister had warned his American counterpart minutes before this was about to unfold that there was a difficult, quote-unquote, operation that was about to get underway in Lebanon. And of course, Hezbollah and Israel have been having daily military clashes over the last 10 months since October the 8th. So there's no doubt that this is part of the larger context of the war in Gaza and the clashes between Hezbollah and Israel. A Monitor newspaper in the United States has reported that this was set up by Israel, this infiltration of these pagers was set up as a potential prelude to a big military operations to create chaos and confusion amongst the ranks of Hezbollah, if and when Israel decided to launch a large operation against Lebanon. It appears that the setup of these explosive charges had been found out by a couple of Hezbollah operatives, and so Israel decided to strike then. It was a case of, as One American official put it to Axios, use it or lose it. And use it, indeed, they did.
And briefly, Kim, do Iran and Hezbollah, backed by Iran, of course, do they want a wider regional war?
They don't want a regional wider war. Otherwise, we'd be in it already. And yes, there have been clashes on the border between Lebanon and Israel. And yes, we've seen the exchange of missiles and drones between Israel and Iran in April. But for all intents and purposes, Iran and Hezbollah's retaliations for various strikes by Israel has shown pragmatic restraint. And every time that Israel feels that it's not being met with a proportionate return fire, it feels that it can go further. And it does every time, with the assassination of Hezbollah leaders, Hamas in Tehran, and now this really a science fiction movie that unfolded in Lebanon. The problem is, this is what I call Middle East roulette. You keep pushing further and further until you actually do ignite a regional war. We'll have to see what Hezbollah response is going to be. And just to note, Amal, that high-ranking members of Hezbollah have been targeted as well. Their sons as well. The Iranian ambassador to Lebanon has possibly lost the use of two of his eyes. So this was also a message from Israel. We know where every single one of you actually is.
Escalation is clearly taking place. Kim Gattis, author of Black Wave, good to talk to you. Thank you.
And we'll cover that in more detail, and also the latest that's happened overnight, as well as the American response from Barack Obama's former security advisor and foreign affairs advisor, all coming up on the programme. At 14 minutes past seven, though, let's turn our attention to the question of whether teachers should be able to do more of their work from home. It's being reported today on the front page of The Telegraph that the government will be allowing teachers greater flexibility in a bid to tackle the recruitment crisis in schools and will be issuing guidance. This has been mooted by the government since July, and part of the reason is that it will hope to stem the tide of women, in particular, leaving teaching when they have children of their own. It follows a successful trial of the scheme at the Dixon's Academies Trust, which runs a number of schools in northern England. Luke Sparks leads that Dixon's Academies Trust. Good morning.
Good morning.
You've been looking at something and trialling something as a nine-day fortnight for teachers, or trying to work towards that. What would that mean?
Yeah, that's something that we've introduced this year. Last year, and for a couple of years now, we've tried to facilitate the opportunity for teachers to be able to work from home, perhaps by coming into school a bit later or being able to go home a bit earlier. But it's this year that we've actually introduced a nine-day fortnight across all of our schools. I mean, education is, you know, is a really hard landscape, but it's also, you know, the work we do is really life-changing. So I think it's important that we do talk up the profession, and there's not many people that can say that about their job, that it's life-changing. But the kind of rise in vacancy rates are very concerning, and we felt that we have to understand that post-millennials are just not going to accept some of the norms that currently exist within our profession, and we can either kind of scoff at that or change. And so we decided that we needed to do something different if we were going to attract those post-millennials who are yet to decide that kind of teaching is the best job in the world.
Well, teaching is one of those jobs we can actually imagine because we've been pupils. Yeah. What does that mean? Where do the teachers go? What hours? When are they at home instead of being at school?
So this is an attempt really to try and give teachers a bit more agency in relation to their working time, because their teachers have very low working time autonomy. So what we will do, what we've done is all of our schools have moved to a kind of 2-week timetable, which some schools will have already had in place. And that means that over the 2 weeks, teachers, there'll be one day in that 2 weeks that teachers don't need to be in school, and they have complete autonomy over that time. So we're not expecting them to work. They can be at home. They can do whatever they please on that day. Some may choose to work to catch up on work. Others may not. It's entirely up to them. But again, it's trying to give just that bit more agency, which is really lacking in the profession. The job is just so rigid with timetables and school days and school terms.
Is that in addition to weekends? Sorry.
Yeah, so that's it. That's over the 10 working days.
Over the 10 working days.
Day. Yeah, they would get one day. Yeah, but they would not need to come to school.
Has that been enough, do you think?
Well, it's early days for us because we've only introduced it this year. Then the actual 9-day fortnight. We've done other things in previous years. The anecdotal feedback we're getting so far is that teachers have really loved it. It's possibly not enough because we know that the kind of professionals that we're trying to attract into the sector, there's other jobs out there that have better pay and even more flexibility. But I think it's a good step in the right direction. And as I said, it's certainly been valued by our colleagues. And we're going to be working with Ambition Institute over the course of the year to really try and analyse exactly the impact. But certainly so far, we're only a couple of weeks into term, staff that I've spoken to have been really positive about it.
Well, we'll see what the government guidance is as well on it. But it's just fascinating because, of course, at the same time, you know, lots of working parents certainly struggle because of school times and that not being flexible in any way, as well as the cost of childcare. So the structure of the school really impacts those working in it and outside it. Perhaps there'll also be changes on that front. Who knows? Luke Sparks, leader of Dixon's Academies Trust.
18 minutes past seven, Bank of England interest rate decision is expected, or is expected, is coming tomorrow. Everyone's thinking about the inflation numbers. What are they? Sean's got more. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Amal. Yes, so the Bank of England will be looking at these. Lots of others will be very aware of how much prices have gone up over the last year and the year to August. And the official numbers this morning say, on average, taking into account all the basket of goods of things that we buy, 2.2% is how much prices rose by the year to August. So just as many expected, unchanged from last month. For the fifth month in a row, it's prices rising by 2 point something. So it feels a world away from the last couple of years where we're often talking about prices overall rising by 8, 9, 10%. Doesn't mean prices are falling, though. Grant Fitzner is chief economist at the Office for National Statistics. Morning, Grant.
Good morning, Sean.
What would the Bank of England be looking into then? We're digging deeper into the numbers here.
Well, as you said, the headline number is in line with expectations, including the bank. So no surprises there, and just above the bank's target of 2%. This is one of the classic months where a few things were contributing to higher inflation, a few things were lower. The main increase this month came from airfares, but they are one of the more volatile monthly series. So I suspect people won't read too much into that, largely offset by further falls in petrol and diesel prices, which I'm sure listeners will be familiar with.
Right. So when the Bank of England looks at the services sector and sees in your data this morning that prices are rising faster in the services area than they were, would they be concerned?
Well, given the airfares were the main reason that CPI services has gone up,
right?
Perhaps not, but obviously I can't speak for the bank. I mean, the longer-term trends is certainly, if you look at most of those sorts of indicators that have been driving inflation lately, food, for example, only up by 1.3% over the year. That's the 17th consecutive month that we've seen food inflation fall. The food inflation rate, that is. Of course, food prices are still going up, but quite modestly. Petrol, I mentioned earlier, has been easing for a while, and certainly looking at the numbers mid-September, look like they are lower next month as well. And then if you look at what prices business are paying for raw materials, they've been weak for some time. So it's hard to see where kind of a significant uptick in inflation might come from at the moment.
What about the budget, the end of next month? Could you be seeing certain policy decisions impact how much prices are rising by?
Well, you can always see the possibility of those kinds of increases. I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Where would that come from? What kind of policies?
Well, it would depend if they directly, affect prices. And the usual suspects for budgets, of course, are things like alcohol, tobacco, fuel, etc., because of course those feed directly into prices when they kick in. Although typically they would tend to come in around April of next year, so they wouldn't have an immediate effect on headline inflation, were that to be the case.
Grant, thank you. Grant Fitzner there, Chief Economist at the Office for National Statistics.
Thanks, Sean. 21 minutes past seven. An extremely rare celestial event took place overnight, a partial eclipse of a supermoon, which is when the moon is apparently closest to the Earth and appears bigger and brighter in the sky. And it was seen across the UK as well as parts of America, Europe and Africa. Did you see it? I didn't. Dr. Carly Howitt is Associate Professor of Space Instrumentation at Oxford University. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very rare event.
Well, it was a combination of things. Each one is quite rare. And then when you combine them, it makes it even more rare. So, yeah, a pretty rare event. A supermoon, as you said, super bright. A harvest moon, which just means it's the full moon closest to the autumnal equinox, which, of course, is on Sunday. And then with a bonus lunar eclipse. So a pretty cool sight.
And for those who did see this, but for those who didn't, what do you see or don't see?
Well, the easiest thing to see is the supermoon, right? Because it was up pretty early last night. I could see it from my bedroom window at about 8 p.m. So you didn't have to be up in the middle of the night to have seen it. The lunar eclipse actually didn't kick in until the middle of the night. So you'd have to be up pretty late to see that. That was between sort of 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. That sort of was, I think, about 3:40 was the peak.
I could have done that.
Yeah, so you could have seen it.
I was up at 3:15. That would have been
there
great.
There you go. But the trouble was, this was a very slight lunar eclipse. So only 4% of the moon was covered. So you might not have, it wasn't an easy thing to have noticed. You'd have to have watched, really studied the moon getting darker and darker. But don't worry. There's going to be a lunar eclipse in 2 years' time, where 96% of the moon is covered. So that one is going to be worth staying up for.
I'm going to set my calendar.
Yeah, there you go. 2 years to wait.
My alarm. But I suppose, what do you think people get from looking at this, being able to see this connect in this way?
Well, I think we're all used to the idea of what, you know, the moon's in the sky and we understand how it looks. But when you see these supermoons, or as astronomers call them, perigean full moons, so I can understand why the public has gone with supermoons.
Yes.
It does look brighter. It's about 30% more brighter. It's a little bit bigger. It's kind of gone from about a 1p coin, which is when it's at the furthest, to about a 10p coin when it's at the closest. So it is bigger and it does look brighter. And I think any time in our regular lives when something looks slightly different, we connect to it in a different way. And I think it's a really good reminder that we should look up and appreciate the moon that we have.
And I also find it fascinating that those who really know when these things are happening as well, that it's part of what they track.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that there's actually two more supermoons. We can track it so well. We know that there's two more supermoons in 2024. So if you missed last night's supermoon, don't worry. There'll be a hunter's supermoon in October, on the 17th of October, and one for the scouts. There's going to be a beaver's supermoon on the 15th of November this year. So some supermoons to come, but you'll have to wait 2 years for another lunar eclipse.
It's good scheduling. Thank you. We're getting across this. In sync here. Dr. Carney Howard, an Associate Professor of Space Instrumentation at Oxford University. Certainly for the Today programme team, we'll be ready.
You said you were doing your online shop at 3:15 this morning.
Yeah, no, I was. I should have been looking at the sky.
Look at the sky. We can't do both.
It's a repeat point. I do the fine edits later.
Of course, yeah. Don't we all? 24 minutes past seven, a conservation charity has declared a national butterfly emergency after its annual account recorded the lowest numbers in its 14-year history. Dr. Dan Hoare is the Director of Conservation at the wildlife charity Butterfly Conservation and joins us now. Dr. Hoare, good morning.
Good morning.
How big a fall in numbers are we talking?
Well, it's a bit of a disaster, to be honest. Every summer, big butterfly conservation's big butterfly count involves thousands of citizen scientists counting butterflies they see in a 15-minute count in sunny weather over a three-week period in the summer. So we got the results in for this year, and they're really not pretty. The average number of butterflies spotted in each count was just 7. That's almost half of the figure for last year, and the lowest in the count's 14-year history.
What's causing the decline?
9,000 counts were logged in which people saw no butterflies at all. 0. And that's the worst in the count's history as well.
So it's
becoming a really rare event to see a butterfly outside when you go outside in the summer.
Astonishingly, I'm so sorry to interrupt, the little delay on the line, I think. What's causing the decline, do you think, Dr. Hoare?
Well, there's a whole range of things. The UK is becoming increasingly hostile for nature. So butterflies are temperature sensitive, so they do struggle in a wet summer. But this goes much deeper than that. Rapidly rising temperatures in winter, extreme weather in summer, from last year's droughts to this year's June washout. About 70% of the UK is farmed, and that's increasingly industrialised and barren, drenched in toxic pesticides. These results are just a sign that we really need to change course because our insect population is collapsing.
Frank Gardner, who's our security correspondent, was doing the bulletins piece about this, and he noted that this is happening across many different species. And of course, butterflies and the different species are a wonderful sight, but they're also, as Frank was saying, they're an important barometer of the health of an ecosystem more generally. What can our listeners who are going to be alarmed by this, what can they do about this?
Well, I think what we're really seeing is that this is happening across a range of species, across a range of places. And what's really terrifying is there are about 20,000 species of insect in the UK doing really important functions underpinning all our ecosystems. These ones, the butterflies, are the most recognisable, easily monitored, and those are collapsing in front of our eyes. So we need to take notice. People as individuals can try and do what they can through butterfly-friendly gardening, for example. But actually what this is showing us is that the real problems are much bigger than that. That's why we're calling on the government to declare a nature emergency to drive coordinated action across government to take this really seriously, so that various policies, from the way we manage farmland to pesticide use, are all kind of approached in a coordinated way. And we want people to sign our open letter to Steve Reid, the Environment Minister, demanding critical action now to safeguard nature.
Dr. Dan Hoare from wildlife charity Butterfly Conservation, thank you.
27 minutes past seven. Carthy's here with the latest sport.
Morning. It was a busy night of football. Liverpool started their Champions League campaign with a 3-1 win over AC Milan, despite the Italian club scoring within the first 3 minutes. Aston Villa beat Swiss champions Young Boys 3-0 in their first game in Europe's top club competition for over 40 years. Harry Kane scored 4 goals for Bayern Munich in their 9-2 win over Dinamo Zagreb. Kane now becomes England's top scorer in Champions League or European Cup history, with 33 goals, overtaking Wayne Rooney's previous record of 30. And tonight, Manchester City host Inter Milan. Celtic face Slovan Bratislava at 8 p.m. There's also League Cup action. Manchester United have a 7-0 win over League One side Barnsley, and there was an extraordinary 16-15 penalty shootout win for Championship side Preston North End over Fulham. All the results are on the BBC Sport website. But it wasn't just a busy night of football. It's a busy year of football, which has been highlighted by the Manchester City midfielder Rodri, who says players are close to going on strike in protest at an increased number of games. Let's speak to the football journalist Henry Winter. Henry, morning. Rodri featured 63 times for his club City and his country Spain last season, winning the Premier League and European Championship. But is that an extreme case?
Morning, Carthy. It is an extreme case, and this probably only affects 150, 200 elite players. But his teammate, Phil Foden, he played 69 games for Manchester City in England. And then you look at one of their teammates, clubmates, who had the summer off, Erling Haaland, because Norway didn't qualify for the Euros. And he spent the summer off chopping trees down in Norway, and he's come back with 9 goals in 4 games. So Rodri is an intelligent, measured individual, and he does have a point.
Well, you've been looking at this subject for a while. What is the opinion of their union, the Professional Footballers Association?
Well, the PFA, who've got a very sort of strong leader, chief executive in Mehete Malongo, and also the FIFPro, who are the sort of the international players union, they're being sort of combining on this, and there's ongoing legal action with FIFA, the world governing body, and that they've also compiled a report, and they basically reviewed the sort of work and polled 1,500 players across Europe, and 54% of them are at risk of fatigue. So I don't know how much sympathy there will be amongst the fans who see clubs with big squads, players like Rodri and Foden, well paid for doing something they love. But ultimately, they do have a point. Fatigue is an issue, physical and mental, and we wouldn't treat racehorses like this.
Well, we're at the point, I think, where the season's almost crossover, the end of Euro 2024 finishing, with the first round of qualifying for this season's Champions League starting. But is there really any possibility of players going on strike, given what you've just said?
I think what they need to do is target FIFA, and particularly the Club World Cup, which has just been parachuted and expanded into the calendar next June. And that is good. So Manchester City and Chelsea qualify for that. So effectively, it's an 11-month season. And that's supposedly a quiet summer, because the summer after that, 26, we've got an expanded World Cup. So they have a point. But the issue is not with the domestic calendar. The issue is with the international calendar. And they have to take their case to FIFA and fight it there.
Yeah, I'm sure this will be an interesting one to follow. Henry Winter, thank you very much. A couple of other headlines for you. Glasgow has confirmed it will host the 2026 Commonwealth Games after a deal was backed by the Scottish Government. The Australian state of Victoria has withdrawn from as the original host due to rising costs. And Simon Easterby will take charge of Ireland's men's rugby union team on an interim basis for the Six Nations, while Andy Farrell is on sabbatical to coach the British and Irish Lions in Australia next summer.
Carthy, thank you.
On BBC iPlayer.
I'm on a train. It's the Glasgow to London night sleeper service.
Brand new drama.
I think we may have a problem.
There's been a hack check-in. Hijacks are so 20th century.
We're being controlled remotely.
This train is now a guided missile.
One of the passengers may be working with the hackers. Don't trust anyone.
You're never getting off, are we?
Night Sleeper. Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
Look at the weather. This morning, any areas of mist and fog and the low cloud in southern and central parts will tend to break up and clear. It will then be a dry, sunny and warm day.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. It is 28 minutes to 8 and here's a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The United Nations, the US and the UK are calling for calm and restraint after at least 9 people were killed and thousands wounded in Lebanon yesterday. Pagers used by members of the militant group Hezbollah exploded almost simultaneously across the country. Hezbollah is blaming Israel and says it will retaliate. Israel hasn't commented. Charities are urging the government not to reduce overseas aid in the budget next month. They say any such move would lead to damaging cuts to life-saving programmes. Foreign aid currently amounts to less than 0.6% of the UK's expenditure. At the general election, Labour promised to return it to 0.7% when circumstances allow. Official figures for last month show that the annual rate of inflation has remained unchanged at 2.2%. The Office for National Statistics says higher airfares have been offset by the lower cost of fuel, restaurants and hotels. The chair of an inquiry into abuse at an immigration removal centre says the government has agreed to implement only one out of her 33 recommendations. Kate Eve says unless more is done, it will be only a matter of time before new reports emerge of abuse at Brooke House near Gatwick Airport. The Home Office says it is committed to ensuring nothing similar can happen again. More than 50,000 junior doctors working in the NHS will from now on be called resident doctors. The change is intended to better reflect their expertise. The doctors' union, the BMA, has been calling for the change, describing the term junior as infantilising and demeaning. A senior judge has described as breathtaking the amount of money some local authorities are being charged by children's homes run by private companies. In one case, a home was charging £16,000 a week to look after a 14-year-old boy who was believed to be involved in selling drugs. Ministers say a new children's wellbeing bill will strengthen regulation of the sector. The American maker of food storage containers, Tupperware, and some of its subsidiaries have filed for bankruptcy. The 78-year-old firm has been struggling with falling sales because of cheaper competition.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's 26 minutes to 8. It's sobering and seemingly not getting any better. In the UK, it's estimated around 1 in every 4 adults and around 1 in every 5 children aged 10 to 11 are living with obesity. But what can be done and who should do it? Here's Tesco's chief executive Ken Murphy speaking about club cards and AI, artificial intelligence, at the FT's Future of Retail Summit yesterday.
Really simple stuff that can transform stuff that you don't really give a whole lot of thought to, that can help to bring your shopping bill down, reduce waste and improve the outcome and the power of that club card. I can also see it nudging you, saying, I've noticed over time in your shopping basket, your sodium salt content is 250% of your daily recommended allowance. I would recommend you substitute this, this and this for lower sodium products to improve your heart health. Very simple stuff, but stuff that we would never do independently.
The chief executive of Tesco. Let's talk now to Henry Dimbleby, author of The National Food Strategy, an independent review for the government, and managing director of Bramble Partners, which invests in sustainable food. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of that idea?
So I think it's really fantastic to hear Ken Murphy. So he said two things there. He said, first of all, we need to help customers. But he also said we need help doing it. And, you know, it's great to hear that there's recognition that the food-related ill health is going to, if we don't get a grip on it, it's going to destroy our health, the NHS and the economy. But he isn't going to be able to do it on his own. So during the food strategy, we talked to the CEO of a supermarket who'd tried to do a similar thing in 5 stores, and they had succeeded in improving the baskets of food that their customers were buying. But all 5 stores lost profitability, so they couldn't roll it out. So I think what he's alluding to there by saying we need help is mandatory reporting of the data, of the health data, which was one of my recommendations, and then create a regulatory playing field. So Sajid Javid, before he resigned, was about to launch a piece of work which will be in the Department for Health about how you could take exactly what he's referring to, the healthiness of the baskets that food companies are serving, and then put in place incentives so that all of them had to improve that over time. So it wasn't just Tesco who would be counting their own profits, everyone would have to do it.
It's just also whether people will like that, you know, the idea that their data is being looked at in that way and they're having this sort of suggestion, as in whether they will welcome it.
Well, I mean, their data is being looked at in this way, whether they like it or not, and they're constantly being marketed to. They're constantly having often, you know, whether it's online, whether it's on social media, unhelpful and destructive attempts to change their behaviour. And I think actually, you know, the work we did suggested that people are quite up for being helped to be healthier. I think that the next step, though, is something much bigger, which is we have some of the best digital records in the NHS. If you can link those to tax and work data, so you understand how health treatments are causing changes in income, which New Zealand do, and then link that to food data, kind of following some of the work that Tim Berners-Lee and Ben Goldacre are doing in Oxford, then we could actually become a powerhouse. We could lead the way using that data to help us become both a more productive and healthier nation. I think that's the real prize that this government should be focusing on.
Well, that's interesting to hear. We'll see what is said about that. Let's bring in Professor Susan Mickey, Director of the Centre for Behaviour Change at UCL and Professor of Health Psychology. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of this idea or this sort of thing? Do you think people would change behaviour?
I think it's got potential to be extremely helpful. But like all technology, it's really important that it's transparent. So what it's essentially doing, as I understand it, is taking people's past shopping behaviour and also possibly other data they put in, such as health data. And on the basis of that, giving them information like, do you realise that your salt consumption of the food you're eating is likely to be much higher than what is recommended, and also making recommendations. For example, we therefore suggest that you substitute X for Y. Now, this in general is very good in terms of people's health, because especially things like salt content, people often have no idea, and it's associated with high blood pressure. It's a silent killer. However, it's really important that people be told what technology is being used, in what way, and for what purposes. So transparency is really important. The other thing that's very important is choice. So as it seems to be at the moment, people just feed in their data and get these recommendations. However, what would be a step better would be they would have a choice about what data they give. Do they want to share their health data, for example, because if they do share their health data, they'll get more useful recommendations, but they may not want to. But also, what are their own goals? So their goals might be to be healthier, but their goals might be to spend less money or to be more sustainable in what they buy.
And try and align those two things for the best results. It's fascinating. Susan, thank you for that. Can I just go back to you very quickly, Henry, and say, I mean, the other issue is you might get a lower salt recommendation, but if you're already not sure of what's actually good for you to buy, isn't that the bigger problem? And, you know, the reliance on ultra-processed food?
Well, I mean, that is a problem, but the way that they saw it, they didn't even use, in these stores that I talked about, these trials, they didn't even use the health data. They simply costed vegetables a bit cheaper. They put vegetables in a different place. They removed the, you know, the bog-offs on ultra-processed foods. They did things that the customer wouldn't even notice, really, just nudging them slightly towards better choices. So if that works, being able to, and I think it's a good idea that the customer gives you permission to do this, I think most of us would, being able to use more complex data to help you improve your health just sounds to me like a complete no-brainer.
Henry Dimbleby, Susan Mickey, thank you. 19 minutes to 8. 9 people, including a child, have been killed after what's been described as an audacious synchronised attack which saw handheld pagers used by members of the armed Iranian-backed group Hezbollah explode across Lebanon. That's what the country's health minister has said on the latest death figures. Iran's ambassador to Lebanon was among the 2,800 other people who were wounded by those simultaneous blasts. Hezbollah, prescribed as a terrorist organisation by Israel, the UK and other countries, relies on pagers for communication due to the risk of mobiles being hacked. It's blamed Israel Israel has declined to comment. There have been almost daily exchanges of fire across the Israel-Lebanon border since the day after the start of the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza after the attacks on Israel on October 7th, which is coming up to just a year in terms of an anniversary there. Frank Gardner, the BBC security correspondent here. Is Israel behind this?
Well, OK, there is no other country or organisation that would have both the desire and the capability, the technical capability, to do something like this. So everyone in the Middle East and elsewhere assumes that Israel was behind this, but Israel is not commenting. I think for your younger listeners, we probably ought to just explain what is a pager, because this is something from the 1980s. It's a one-way communication device. You can't transmit on it. It only receives. And the reason that Hezbollah ordered thousands of these pagers from reportedly from a company called Gold Apollo in Taiwan was that it didn't trust mobiles. Its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, told his followers right back at the beginning of the Gaza conflict in October, be careful about using mobiles because Israeli military intelligence will track you according to where your mobile is using GPS. Pagers don't use GPS. But a single message that appeared to come from Hezbollah leadership activated those pagers that people were carrying mostly in their pockets and their trousers, occasionally in their hands, and that detonated probably 10 to 20 grams of military-grade high explosive, probably HMX or RDX, that was hidden in a component inside those pagers. So somebody was able to tamper with them in the supply chain before they reached Hezbollah.
But there's been, talk of what's the strategic goal here? If it is Israel, if it is the intelligence agency, Mossad, what's the plan? How does that fit in with what we've seen before from Israel when this sort of, as people have described it, audacious hit is happening?
Well, it's a psychological blow for Hezbollah and for Iran, its major backer, because these explosions went off right throughout southern Lebanon, into the Bekaa Valley, even in Damascus and further east, quite possibly in Iran itself. And it's a demonstration to Hezbollah that Israel is technically superior to them, and it's a warning. Israel has already extended its war aims recently, in the last 2 days, to include pushing Hezbollah back from the border because it's fed up with all the rockets and missiles that are coming across that border that have displaced around 60,000 Israeli residents. Now, I have to say that the damage on the Lebanese side is far greater. A greater number of Lebanese residents, including civilians as well as Hezbollah fighters, have been killed. I think around 600 Hezbollah fighters have so far been killed since October, and around 46 Israelis. But there's a lot of political pressure on the Netanyahu government to do something about Hezbollah. Israel's a small country, and people are saying we can't go on with this, with our northern border being so unsafe. So it's a message to Hezbollah. It's, I mean, okay, 11 people killed, which is tough, including a girl who was possibly nothing to do with Hezbollah, but these were, in the most part, non-fatal injuries. 99% of them caused injuries, some of them very serious, but they were non-fatal. So it's a message, almost certainly from Israel, to Hezbollah and to Iran, yes, that Israel's got that technological capability.
Frank Gardner, the BBC security correspondent, thank you.
7:45, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Bishop Richard Harries.
Good morning. A major exhibition of Van Gogh's paintings has just opened at the National Gallery. His is an extraordinary story. He created over 2,000 works of art, but only one was sold in his lifetime. Now he's recognized as being one of the most influential figures in the history of Western art, and in our time, probably the most popular. In his early life, Vincent Van Gogh was deeply religious, and for a time worked as a missionary amongst miners in Belgium. It's not surprising that the paintings of the last period of his life in the south of France have a religious intensity about them. It's as though he wanted to paint the sheer isness of what was before him, whether it was a chair, a boot, or a sunflower. Like his exact contemporary, Gerard Manley Hopkins, He wants to convey the extraordinary fact that something actually exists, and that it exists in its unique particularity. Van Gogh had a particular interest in the parable of the sower, and painted more than 30 pictures on the subject. Some of them have a dark side, reflecting his own tendency to depression. But my favourite is The Sower at Sunset, painted at Arles in 1888, which is totally joyous. It shows a farmer scattering seed on an iridescent blue soil, whilst behind him a field of shimmering corn stands high. Above, a golden sun sends its rays across the sky. In the parable which Jesus told about a sower, some seed falls on the path, some on rocky ground, some amongst thorns, but some falls on good soil and brings forth grain, and as he put it, some 30, some 60, some 100-fold. In short, much seems totally wasted, but that which thrives does so abundantly. It's that sense of glorious abundance that comes across in this painting. There is an ultimate optimism in this image, as well as other images of Jesus, which Van Gogh has captured. Although there is so much loss in life, yet the good we do will in the end produce a wonderful harvest. Those tiny acts of selflessness, when we act for the good of others, not ourselves, when in Christian terms we hear the word of God and act on it, will bring forth amazing flourishing, both in this life and in the world to come. So much of the time we're conscious of wasted lives, of irrecoverable loss, and that's very real, as Van Gogh knew. But his great gift to us is his sense that there is also joy and glory in the sheer fact of existence, and in this painting in particular, an ultimate hopefulness about life.
That was Thought for the Day with Bishop Richard Harries. The time now is 12 minutes to 8. Save for a few very targeted interventions, Sir John Major has generally avoided big interviews in recent years. One reason for that is that he had, well, major qualms with many of the policies and practices of the party he led. Not just on Brexit, where his views are no secret, but also on issues like immigration and the Rwanda deportation scheme. He feels the recent general election gives him the freedom to say what he really thinks about the Conservatives, about the future of the party, and about the future of this country, but also about the world today, not least what's at stake in Ukraine, why democracy has been retreating across the globe too. But when I spoke to him at length, we started by talking about the Rwanda scheme.
Well, if you really wish to know, I thought it was unconservative and British, if one dare say it, in a secular society, unchristian and unconscionable. We used to transport people nearly 300 years ago from our country, felons who at least had had a trial. I don't think transportation, for that is what it is a policy suitable for the 21st century.
Well, let me challenge you on that, because a lot of people, some in your party, some outside of your party, some that were once in your party would say, what's really unconservative or unchristian is allowing this boat crossing to continue. And the way you stop it, and this was the argument of the former British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, the way you stop it is by having an effective deterrent. And you could tell that the Rwanda scheme was going to be a deterrent because other countries were looking at it and were thinking about whether or not they might do a similar thing. So isn't it actually the compassionate view to take all measures necessary to stop the boats, as someone once said, and isn't the threat of deportation to Rwanda part of that policy?
Well, it doesn't seem to have been working. The threat has been there for some time. It hasn't stopped people coming. Are they seriously saying to me that somewhere in the backwoods of some North African country they actually know what the British Parliament has legislated for? I think not. But there are ways in which we can deal with this, better ways. Every nation in Europe has got this problem. Let me put it in a wider context because it's a long-term problem.
And it's a hard problem to solve, let's be honest about this.
It's a very hard problem.
Very big trade-offs involved.
No, it's a very hard problem to solve.
You're working with tough guys.
Which is why, over the last year, I kept my mouth shut about what I thought about it. It is a very hard problem to solve. So how do we solve that problem? Let us seek out where these rubber boats actually are manufactured, often China. Let us ban their import into the whole of Europe. Let us work together beyond China, where the boats have gone to, where people go there, and seek out the gangs working with the local countries. Not just Britain, but working with our partners all across Europe. Doesn't mean you're reinventing the European Union. They have a similar problem to us. Collectively, we can provide a bigger deterrent.
What kind of health is
the Conservative Party in today?
Well, it's had a whopping great electoral defeat. I may be deceiving myself, though I don't think so. But I think a large part of our nation is by instinct centre-right. Not far-right, but centre-right. And the only party that can legitimately appeal to the centre-right is the Conservative Party. And that is what we have to do. People may have made a misjudgment about the last election. We lost 5 votes to Reform UK. We lost 50 to the Liberals. And we lost a huge amount to Labour. We lost the vote on the left more than on the right. And we have to focus on that centre-right position.
Have you made up your mind about who you'll support to be the next leader?
I will look and see what they have to say. I'd like to support someone who's going to look at the long-term problems and make a suggestion as to which direction we should go. As to have I made up my mind, no, I haven't.
I heard a story about how after you were voted out of office in 1997, you said to a young George Osborne, who was then your press advisor, that the great danger for your party was to be taken over by its right wing. What's the great danger today?
Well, I don't think the Conservative Party should be taken over by any part of it. There are different strands of conservatism. We need the right wing. What we don't need is the far right, people who've attracted themselves to the right wing, who perhaps would be more comfortable in Reform UK than with us. But I don't want to dispense with the right wing of the Conservative Party. They are a very important, valuable part of the Tory Party. What I want is for them to reach a concordat, and so that we don't have these factional disputes within the party. They have done enough damage to us in more than one election.
But why do you say it would be fatal to merge with Reform UK? A lot of people think Nigel Farage should be in the Tory Party.
Well, I don't share that view.
Why?
Because I don't think he's a Conservative. And he spent most of his time in the last few years telling people how much he dislikes the Conservative Party and would like to destroy it. I don't think that's a terribly good background for bringing someone into the party.
What has Brexit done to and for your party?
Well, Brexit has been the most divisive thing that has happened in our party in my lifetime. It is less important what it has done to our party than what it has done to our country. It's made our country weaker, poorer. The world saw us as a member of the European Union. When we spoke, they believed we had 500 million Europeans essentially behind us in what we spoke. It was a megaphone to magnify our power in the world. Similarly, they saw us as the closest advocates in Europe for the United States. So you take two of the three most powerful blocs in the world. We were the closest ally of one, and we're now less close than we were, and we were part of the other, and we're no longer in the other.
Could it not have fulfilled the promise of those who advocated it, which is that it would make us richer and more free?
We are a trading nation. And what have we just done? We have broken away from the largest, richest free trade market the world has ever seen. And we were in the middle of it as a leading part of it, and we have broken away from it. What has happened to all the benefits of Brexit that we heard about?
Well, maybe they are yet to come.
I don't recall people saying during the election campaign, in 10 or 15 years' time, maybe 20, we'll have some benefits of Brexit.
But do you not grant that there could be?
No, stop a minute. It was going to be milk and honey straight away, and it wasn't milk and honey. And Brexit was sold to the nation on the basis of things that haven't happened and couldn't have happened. People said we were going to get our sovereignty back. Well, up to a point, that's true. We now have sovereignty to be poorer.
But a lot of people listening to you might say, you know what, immigration was too high, we wanted it lower, and Brexit was our best hope of voting for lower migration. What do you say to them?
Well, I would simply point to the reality of what has happened. It was said that we were going to control our borders. It was another of those three-word slogans, get Brexit done, control our borders. There are a whole range of them that were slogans rather than properly thought-out policy. And the reality is quite different from what was promised. And that is true about immigration as well.
How would you describe Britain's standing in the world today compared with, say, 20 years ago?
Well, it's obviously a little less than it was. The world has changed. And I think we have a role to play in that. Let me give you a practical illustration. Let us suppose that the American president ceases to be active alongside Ukraine. Let us suppose Germany ceases to be active alongside Ukraine, and Ukraine loses and Russia wins. How does the world see that? They will see that the West has funked and failed to protect a democracy in Europe, of all places. China will notice that. What happens to the allies of the West? Do they decide we're safer to line up behind China Or do they say, then we had better be prepared to protect ourselves better and start moving towards nuclear capability? That's why I think Russia need to be defeated. And we should try and lead people into believing that it is right for us to defend Ukraine, because you are defending freedom against autocracy. And if you begin to weaken and lose on a mega scale, then there will be a price to pay for that.
That was Sir John Major. There is a 45-minute interview on BBC iPlayer now, and also at 7 p.m. on BBC Two. There's also a longer version on BBC Sounds. Please just search for Amol Rajan Interviews John Major.
Let's get the latest weather. It's 3 minutes to eight. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Emma. Well, we've got a dry and fairly warm spell of weather that's set to continue through today into tomorrow, and for many of us for the next few days as well. But it's something of a north-south split to the weather today, because in the south we've got a bit more cloud and breeze developing, whereas further north there'll be lighter winds. So if you're across all of southern England through Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, you may have caught a glimpse of the partial lunar eclipse of the harvest supermoon last night. But for some of us, there was too much cloud around. Now, that cloud is going to thin and break over the next few hours, clearing away fairly quickly. So some longer spells of sunshine developing through the day. You'll notice a northeasterly breeze coming in, especially so for East Anglia, the southeast and around the south coast of England. But top temperatures right across the region, 20 to 24 degrees. So it will feel quite pleasant. Just a little cooler close to those east coasts. For Northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, we've got a few mist and fog patches. They're going to clear away pretty quickly, and then light winds, lots of sunshine on offer, and it's going to feel pleasantly warm for this stage in September. 21 to perhaps 25 degrees, probably the warmest weather today across the northwest of Scotland. Into this evening and tonight, a bit like last night, we've got some low cloud rolling in from the east, and we've also got some mist and some fog patches. They should clear away tomorrow, so tomorrow very similar to today, dry, settled and warm too. But things are going to turn increasingly unsettled with some showers moving across southern areas towards the end of the week.
Sarah, thank you.
Rethink. I'm Professor Ben Ansell, and I'll be taking a fresh look at the issues of our time with a panel of experts.
I think it would be helpful if people on all sides could accept that some problems don't have an easy solution.
What changes should we make? What should we be rethinking?
That is the kind of thing that we should have public deliberation around.
It's a very inconsistent set of rules.
I'll scrutinise the latest research and take a look at what this might mean for policy and society.
But it is also a heated debate, and that's because it's an important topic. It's about who we are.
Rethink on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, tomorrow afternoon at 4.
Coming up in the next hour of this programme, former advisor to Obama, Ben Rhodes, on the potential for further escalation in the Middle East following what's been described as an astounding attack on pagers in Lebanon.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of September. The headlines this morning. The United Nations says a coordinated attack in Lebanon on a Hezbollah communications network marks an extremely concerning escalation in the Middle East. Charities have warned the government that potential cuts to foreign aid would damage life-saving programs. The kitchen favourite Tupperware has filed for bankruptcy. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The United Nations says the simultaneous explosion of pagers used by Hezbollah in Lebanon marks an extremely concerning escalation in tensions in the Middle East. At least 9 people were killed and nearly 3,000 wounded in blasts across the country yesterday. Hezbollah has blamed Israel and promised to respond. In a statement, the group says its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, will make a speech tomorrow to address the latest developments. Israel is yet to comment. The UK has called for calm heads and de-escalation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yulan Nell.
Already, fears were running high of a new escalation between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel's leaders have been threatening to step up military action to return thousands of displaced citizens from the north of the country to their homes after nearly a year of cross-border fighting sparked by the war in Gaza. Now Hezbollah has threatened retaliation for the latest dramatic, wide-scale attack. While Israel's military has declined to comment, international media quote unnamed US and Lebanese Lebanese sources, saying that Israeli operatives hid small amounts of explosive material within a new batch of pagers imported into Lebanon. This morning, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Egypt to discuss Gaza ceasefire talks. A State Department spokesperson in Washington said it was too early to say if the attack in Lebanon would affect negotiations, but insisted the US was clear that diplomacy was the way to reduce tensions.
The Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Gold Apollo has denied claims it made the pagers used in the attacks. The allegations have been reported by some US media. From Taipei, here's our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
A team of police investigators are now inside the Gold Apollo offices in Taipei, questioning staff and examining documents. The company itself says it has nothing to do with the attacks in Lebanon or the devices involved. Company founder Xu Qingguang told reporters that 3 years ago his company had signed an agreement with another company called BAC Consulting, which has an address in Budapest. He said the agreement gave BAC the right to manufacture pagers under his company's logo. "We only provided brand trademark authorization," he said, "and have no involvement in the design or manufacturing of this product." Mr. Xu told reporters he was extremely shocked about what had happened in Lebanon and that his company is also a victim.
More than 120 international charities have urged the government to protect foreign aid spending from cuts in next month's budget. In a letter to the Prime Minister seen by the BBC, they say reductions could leave aid spending at its lowest level since 2007. The Foreign Office said the government would return to spending 0.7% of national income on aid as soon as fiscal circumstances allowed. Here's our diplomatic correspondent James Landell.
The annual foreign aid budget is about £13 billion, but in recent years much of it's been spent not on humanitarian crises overseas, but on housing asylum seekers in the UK. As a result, the Conservatives gave the aid budget a £2.5 billion top-up, but that was only for 2 years, and charities fear the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will not renew it when she announces her budget. In their letter to Sir Keir Starmer, 120 charities, including Oxfam and Save the Children, say that would mean damaging cuts to life-saving programmes. They urge the Prime Minister to keep aid spending at current levels, about 0.58% of national income, and spend less on asylum seekers' hotels.
Official figures released this morning show inflation was unchanged at 2.2% last month. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, said the more manageable level of inflation was welcome, but acknowledged many people were still struggling. Here's our Chief Economics Correspondent, Darshini David.
The price of goods such as furniture and food kept the inflation rate close to the official 2% target. However, the prices of services, watched closely by the Bank of England in its quest to keep inflation down, rose more quickly, at a rate of 5.6% due to higher airfares. But those are volatile, and the bank had expected this increase. With inflation for the likes of hotel stays and restaurant meals dwindling, it expects price pressures for services more widely to fade in coming months, and so analysts expect another interest rate cut in November. But although the spike in inflation is behind us, many bills remain far higher than a few years ago.
In his first interview since the Conservatives' general election defeat in July, the former Prime Minister Sir John Major has said his party needs to reject the far right. He also warned that any merger with Reform UK would be fatal. Sir John said he was still to decide who he would support in the Tory leadership contest, adding the party should move on from internal divisions.
We need the right wing. What we don't need is the far right. People who've attracted themselves to the right wing, who perhaps would be more comfortable in Reform UK than with us. And so that we don't have these factional disputes within the party. They have done enough damage to us in more than one election.
The chair of an inquiry into abuse at Brooke House Immigration Removal Centre near Gatwick Airport says ministers have only agreed to one out of 33 recommendations made in her report a year ago. The Home Office has insisted it is committed to ensuring the abuse that took place at Brooke House can never happen again. Tom Simons reports.
The Brooke House inquiry report detailed 19 serious incidents where detainees were abused by staff following an undercover investigation by BBC Panorama in 2017. There were 33 recommendations, but so far only one has been agreed. This involved making clear to detention staff that detainees shouldn't be handcuffed behind their backs when seated, which can lead to asphyxiation. Kate Eaves, the inquiry chair, said the response of the Conservative government had been inadequate and disappointing, and Labour also needed to show more commitment. Without it, and with independent monitors already warning of a rise in violence at the centre, she said it becomes a question of when, not if, such abuses will come to light again.
The food container business Tupperware Brands has filed for bankruptcy in the United States. The firm is reported to have debts of more than £500 million. Our correspondent Marika Oy reports.
Founded in 1946 by chemist Earl Tupper, the company's popularity exploded in the 1950s. It also enjoyed a brief resurgence during the pandemic as families sheltered at home and cooked more, resulting in lots of leftovers. That surge was short-lived as sales declined, with a rising cost of raw materials such as resin also hitting the company's bottom line. Analysts also say the fundamentals of Tupperware's products are not difficult to copy. The company has reported debts equivalent to £530 million. Bankruptcy will see what can be recovered.
Sightings of butterflies across the UK have fallen to their lowest level in 14 years. Conservationists say the decline is partly because of an obsession with tidiness in gardens and across the countryside. More from our environment correspondent Helen Briggs.
Those taking part in this summer's big butterfly count recorded an average of 7 butterflies in a 15-minute period. Last year, the number was 12. Butterfly Conservation says the figures are so alarming it's declared a nationwide butterfly emergency and is calling for a total ban on pesticides known to harm butterflies and bees. Neonicotinoids were banned in the UK in 2018 but have been approved several times for emergency use in farming. The government has said it intends to ban the use of neonicotinoid pesticides but has given no timescales for doing so.
Two British soldiers who were killed during attempts to liberate the Netherlands during the Second World War are to be buried after their remains were recovered and identified using advances in DNA testing. Private Henry Moon and Lieutenant Dermot Green Anderson will both receive full military honours in ceremonies attended by their families at Arnhem's Oosterbeek War Cemetery. Anna Holligan takes up the story.
Henry Moon and Dermot Green Anderson both died taking part in Operation Market Garden in 1944. It was an ambitious plan by the Allies to capture bridges at Arnhem in the Netherlands and help free the country from Nazi occupation. Private Henry Moon was part of the ground offensive sent to support airborne troops. He was killed in action at the age of 21. Dermot Green Anderson was a glider pilot in the Army Air Corps. He flew into a village northwest of Arnhem where he was killed by an enemy shell just hours before the evacuation order was given. Today, soldiers from the Royal Yorkshire Regiment and Army Air Corps will carry their coffins. Those behind their reburials say they're designed to restore their dignity and to stand as a powerful reminder of the human cost of war and the legacy of those who fought.
A museum in London has announced it will host a major retrospective of about 50 paintings by Sir Winston Churchill in 2026. The exhibition at the Wallace Collection will span the former Prime Minister's artistic career, which began during the First World War and continued until the 1960s. Some of the work being loaned to the museum has rarely, if ever, been seen in public.
Jane, thanks very much. It's 8:10. In what's been described as an audacious, daring and extremely deadly attack, at 3:30pm local time yesterday, handheld pagers used by members of the armed Iranian-backed group Hezbollah simultaneously exploded across Lebanon and the region. 9 people, including a child, have been killed and nearly 3,000 injured. Iran's ambassador to Lebanon was among those wounded. Hezbollah, proscribed as a terrorist organisation by the UK and other countries, has blamed Israel. Israel has declined to comment. There have been almost daily exchanges of fire across the Israel-Lebanon border since the day after the start of the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, after the attacks on Israel by Hezbollah's ally Hamas, also proscribed by the UK government as a terrorist organisation, on October the 7th, nearly a year ago. Hours before the explosions, Israel's security cabinet said stopping Hezbollah attacks on the north of the country to allow the safe return of displaced residents was now an official war goal. Many Lebanese people were in a state of shock and disbelief last night, unable to get their heads around an event that was unprecedented in scale and nature. The US claims it knew nothing of the coordinated attack, but what will be and should be President Biden's response as his team continues to push publicly for a ceasefire and de-escalation in the region? And how should Israel defend itself against Hezbollah's fire? I've been speaking to Ben Rhodes, who is President Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor.
Clearly, something like this, fairly indiscriminate use of violence against, you know, potentially hundreds of Hezbollah operatives in all parts of Lebanon, dramatically raises the risk of escalation because Hezbollah will feel the need to respond, and because it could be the precursor to a more significant Israeli military operation in Lebanon.
We've got a situation where Israel hasn't commented on this. America said overnight it wasn't aware of the incident in advance. But if Israel's done this without warning, how do you think U.S. officials will react to that?
It's fairly obvious that Israel did this. And there's just nobody else that would engage in this kind of attack against Hezbollah. I think from the U.S. perspective, this is not what the U.S. wanted. This is not what the Biden administration wanted. They had an envoy, Amos Hochstein, in Israel as recently as a couple of days ago, urging against escalation. You know, once again, I think this is the Netanyahu government, you know, ignoring what the Biden administration is telling them. But, you know, frankly, candidly, believing that there's no consequences to that. And so I think, you know, this probably puts, you know, Israel in a position that the U.S. doesn't want them to be in terms of militarizing and potentially escalating the conflict in Lebanon. And yet, you know, I would expect that there won't be any consequences from the U.S. administration.
Why won't there be?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Joe Biden has just been reluctant to use any leverage beyond kind of diplomatic messages and, you know, consistent pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza and de-escalation in Lebanon. But, you know, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu is just moving in a different direction. And if you look at the signals coming out of Israel, you have Netanyahu, you know, reportedly considering getting rid of his defense minister in part over differences about whether or not to pursue an offensive in Lebanon. You have Netanyahu, along with Hamas, obviously, consistently going to the precipice of a ceasefire and a deal to get hostages in exchange for a more comprehensive ceasefire in Gaza, and then walking back from that. And, you know, so I just feel like where we are is we're, you know, continued to, you know, be faced with the horror of the war in Gaza and continue to face this regional escalation, which I should say is, you know, both the potential for an Israeli operation in Lebanon because they have, you know, a displaced population in northern Israel. But also, Iran is obviously, you know, a close ally of Hezbollah, a key supporter of Hezbollah. The Iranian ambassador to Lebanon was injured in this attack. And so there continues to be this kind of risk of a regional escalation. And that's what the U.S. really fears as well, because that could potentially put at risk, you know, U.S. Forces in the region, U.S. diplomatic presence in countries like Iraq, where Iran and Hezbollah have proxies. So, you know, this continues to be a very tense situation.
Hezbollah is a proscribed terrorist organization by Israel, UK, other countries around the world. There will be those who, even if Israel never take any responsibility for this, that Israel has a right to defend itself.
Well, you know, Israel has a, you know, right to defend itself. And, you know, there has been rocket fire from Hezbollah into Israel. You know, clearly that's
consistently,
you know, consistently, and that's displaced tens of thousands of Israelis. So there's no question that there's a very real threat from Hezbollah. I mean, I think that is kind of part of the conflict in Gaza, right? So the only way to truly de-escalate this situation is to arrive at some kind of ceasefire in Gaza.
No, but
at the same time,
I was just going to say, is that reality why America ultimately won't do anything on this particular development?
Yeah, but I mean, look, I understand the need for Israel to defend itself against Hezbollah. At the same time, this is a pretty, you know, indiscriminate use of violence. It's part of this kind of creeping escalation and disregard for potential civilian harm that might achieve, you know, a tactical objective for Israel. This clearly is going to set back Hezbollah's capabilities in the same way that they've set back Hamas's capabilities, but it's not going to eliminate Hezbollah. And so the question is where is this all going? What is the strategy behind what the Israeli government is doing? Because they are able to kind of operate with this impunity in terms of dealing tactical blows to Hamas, to Hezbollah, to Iran. And yet, their international position is weakening. There's going to clearly be, I think, sympathy in across the Middle East for Lebanon and for the Lebanese people and for, in some cases, Hezbollah. And so it just kind of keeps things in this kind of status quo of, an escalatory cycle that does not have a very clear end in sight.
If you were advising President Biden now, what would you say?
I would say that the only pathway to de-escalate, you know, the U.S. does not want a regional war, which is kind of what we already have. I'd say that the real pathway to de-escalation is through Gaza. Hamas is not going to be destroyed militarily by the Israeli military operation. The hostages are not going to be rescued in the numbers that we would like militarily. And so I'd be utilizing U.S. leverage. You know, I'd be conditioning military assistance. I'd be willing to entertain Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire. I'd be putting substance behind what are the U.S. positions.
But it's fascinating that that's not happening at the moment.
It's not. And isn't that telling
in itself perhaps about America's position and its view on the use of, as you describe it, indiscriminate violence back towards Israel?
Yeah, no, and I just think it ultimately that's not in America's interest. We talk a lot about a rules-based order. Mm. The whole basis of our position on Ukraine globally is the need to enforce a set of norms related to the use of force and the protection of civilians. Obviously, it's a different circumstance in the sense that Israel was attacked on October 7th. But look, I mean, you know, for the U.S., this is a gift to those who say the U.S. operates on double standard. Prime Minister Netanyahu, to me, is the variable here because he is somebody that likes to pick fights with U.S. presidents, particularly Democratic U.S. presidents. He's someone who I think has calculated that the perpetuation of the open-ended military operation in Gaza and the escalation across the region has strengthened his position politically in Israel, where he was quite vulnerable after the October 7th attacks. And there's a long body of evidence that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not somebody who's going to kind of be persuaded through private communications from the U.S. president. I mean, obviously, this is an impressive operation. The question is the tactical setback to Hezbollah worth the escalation risk, worth the reputational risk, worth the establishment of a new norm that suggests that this is kind of an acceptable use of force? And on all those things, I think the jury is very much still out.
Ben Rhodes, President Obama's deputy national security advisor, when he was in the White Office, of course, White House rather. Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, is listening to that. An audacious synchronized attack against a group prescribed by the UK government and others as terrorists. What is the latest?
Well, the latest is, as Ben Rhodes was telling you, that Israel has scored a significant tactical triumph, really, in this extraordinary operation, that a spectacular coup, that sort of thing you read about in a thriller. And undoubtedly, it's a humiliation for Hezbollah. It's bad for their morale. It increases their insecurity. But there is a serious strategic downside, potentially, for the Israelis, because while this humiliates the Lebanese militia, it doesn't deter them and it doesn't get closer to Israel's strategic aim of stopping the fire going into their country and allowing those Israelis, 60,000 plus, who haven't been in their homes for getting on for a year, back to them.
I mean, again, we should, I suppose, keep caveating if it is Israel to the point that it's not actually been admitted, but it's been said by many it could only be at this point. In terms of a response from Iran, have we heard anything on that?
No, not as yet. There have been reports suggesting that the ambassador isn't as badly hurt. Their ambassador to Lebanon, who was injured in this attack, that he wasn't as badly hurt as people thought. I think that undoubtedly Hezbollah and their allies in Iran will be sort of licking their wounds at the moment. But, you know, I think that once again, the region has been pushed right to the brink of an all-out war. sooner or later they will fall over the cliff if this continues. And it's hard to see, apart from the fact that it looks as if, according to reports in a reputable Middle East newsletter, which is called Al Monitor, the plan originally was to use these booby trap pages as the first blow in a big escalation, an offensive, an invasion perhaps, of southern Lebanon. But the reports were that Hezbollah was getting suspicious, so Israel was forced to trigger this attack prematurely. So it's used an important and audacious weapon, which clearly is very effective in their terms, but they haven't used it, if this is the case, in the way that they were hoping, which was then to follow it up with devastating attacks while Hezbollah were reeling. And so while they've used this, they've shown that they've got inside their communications, they've shown they can humiliate them. It doesn't, as I say, take the region one inch back from an all-out war. It
what
pushes
would, though,
it
Jeremy?
Closer
is it,
to that.
Is there any view on what would stop Hezbollah, for instance, firing?
I think, as Ben Rhodes was telling you earlier on, everything at the moment in terms of de-escalation in the Middle East depends on Gaza. While that war is going on, nothing, whether it's in Lebanon, whether it's in the Red Sea with the Houthis, whether it's in Iraq, nothing is going to de-escalate. The American envoy, Amos Hochstein, has been working assiduously, talking to the Lebanese, not directly to Hezbollah, but to people who talk to them, and also talking to the Israelis about trying to find a way to de-escalate this diplomatically. And the Israelis didn't tell the Americans what they were doing until moments before it, reportedly. So it's not going to help his efforts.
Jeremy Bowen, thank you for that. Our international editor on the latest on that story, which, you know, has extraordinary detail in it.
23 minutes past eight. Big changes are supposedly coming to teenager accounts on Instagram, the popular social media app owned by Meta, which is also parent company to Facebook, WhatsApp, and many, many other services. Instagram allows 13-year-olds and those above to sign up, but after the privacy changes that have just been announced, all designated accounts will be turned into teen accounts automatically, and they'll be private by default. Those accounts can only be messaged and tagged by accounts that they follow or are already connected to, and sensitive content settings will be the most restrictive available. These are big changes for teenagers on social media. The other changes include the fact that offensive words and phrases will be automatically filtered out of both comments and direct messages, and teenagers will get notifications telling them to leave the app after 60 minutes each day. There's also going to be a sleep mode automatically turned on between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. The same changes are now in force across the US, Canada and Australia. What impact will they have? Well, Mark Bunting is the online safety director at Ofcom and joins us now. Mark, good morning.
Morning, Amol. Thanks for inviting me on.
Our pleasure. How, in your view, will this change the lives of teenagers in Britain?
Well, these announcements are very much in line with proposals we made earlier this year in our draft online safety codes of practice. We do know that parents and children are concerned, particularly about younger users being approached by strangers online. We made a number of proposals to ensure that services make it harder for children to be contacted by people they don't know. It's good to see this step in the right direction from Meta. We've been working closely with industry since the legislation passed to make sure firms understand the new rules, and we're already seeing some platforms respond to regulation ahead of time. But I think it is important to be clear, it's only a start, and we will be monitoring closely to make sure that services are doing everything they should to protect their users.
And what's to stop kids just lying about their age?
Well, that's one of the issues that we want to see more action on. We do know that children often give false dates of birth, and services historically haven't done enough to check the age of their users. In some cases, they've done very little. And of course, these protections will only apply to teens that Instagram know are teens. And we're going to be looking to services to make more changes to make sure that they know which of their users are under 18.
I know you're a regulator rather than a politician, but some people listening to you, Mark, might say, if we're worried about teenagers who are impressionable with elastic and plastic minds being exposed to harmful stuff, why don't we just ban it? You know, there is this growing movement across in America, a lot of it following the work of Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist who's written that book, The Anxious Generation. If you look at what's coming out of Australia, where this week they've said actually smartphone access is going to be very heavily restricted for young people. Why, if we're worried about young people and safety, why don't we just go the whole hog and ban it?
Well, I think there is this global debate developing, as you say, about child use of social media and other services. We've got a very particular role, which is to make sure that services that are available to younger users are safe for younger users. We want children to be able to benefit from the best that the internet has to offer. And as you say, if government and parliament wish to make further changes in this area,
yeah, it's your job to enforce those regulations rather than to come up with legislation. Exactly. I do get that. Okay, have a listen to this, if you would, Mark. This is online safety campaigner Ian Russell, who I know you all know well. Our listeners will know him well. His daughter Molly killed herself when she was 14 after being exposed to very depressing content on social media, particularly on Instagram. And this is Ian Russell's assessment of this week's announcement.
It's always really hard to judge the level of effectiveness that the changes social media companies introduce might have. For example, in 2019, when we first spoke publicly about Molly, Instagram said that they would no longer allow graphic self-harm content on the platform. And yet, November of last year, when the Molly Rose Foundation did some research, we found content very similar to the content that Molly had been looking at in the 6 months before she died, still there and still pretty easy to find. That wasn't effective. So at the point of announcement, when there's lots of detail to dig into and get to understand, it's hard to be conclusive. There are measures in this announcement that seem to be a step forward, but there are also questions raised. And it's only when we've got answers to those questions and we see how effective this is in practice that we'll really know.
Well, that was Ian Russell. That was Ian Russell, father of Molly Russell, talking to our sister programme, The World at One, yesterday. And I think the central point that he makes, Mark, is that we've often heard the social media platforms and companies make these great change claims for what they will change. And in fact, years later, sod all has changed. What do you say to that argument?
So I really agree with Ian's analysis there. This will be the first time that big social media services have had independent, robust regulatory scrutiny applied to the changes that they're making. We think that point about assessing the effectiveness of these changes is absolutely key. We published a paper earlier this year about how services could go about evaluating the impact of the changes that they make. It's an area that we'll really want to look closely at to industry to take a leading position on.
All right, Mark Bunting, Online Safety Director for Ofcom. Thank you very much indeed.
It is 28 minutes past eight. Garthy's just walked back in. Let's get the latest on the sport. Hello.
Hello, thank you very much.
Like she's really late. It was, she's been sat there for a good
minute. Well, I didn't run in, thankfully.
Well, she has rejoined us, that she's not sat there the whole time. She's finding out what's happening.
I am. Talking about the Champions League first. They returned last night with a 3-1 win for Liverpool over AC Milan and for Aston Villa, who beat Young Boys 3-0 in their first game in Europe's top club competition for over 40 years. Tonight, Manchester City hosts Inter Milan. Celtic face Slovan Bratislava. Last night, Manchester United had a 7-0 win over League One side Barnsley in the third round of the English League Cup, and there was a 16-15 penalty shootout win for Championship side Preston North End over Fulham. All results, as usual, on the BBC Sport website. Now, Glasgow has confirmed it will host the 2026 Commonwealth Games after a deal was backed by the Scottish Government. The Australian state of Victoria withdrew as the original host due to rising costs. Well, the funding of sports events like the Commonwealth Games, and particularly the scale of fossil fuel sponsorship in sport, is the subject of a report by the New Weather Institute, which is out today. The report states that major oil and gas companies are spending at least $5.6 billion on the sponsorship of global sport, with the United Nations General Secretary, Antonio Guterres, expected to call for an end to alliances with the oil and gas sector in the UN's Summit of the Future this month. I've been speaking to the Paris 2024 Olympic rowing champion, Imogen Grant, who is also a doctor, about fossil fuel sponsorship.
The climate crisis is growing, and I think this report is going to highlight that sport at the moment is being used to improve the perception of these dirty companies that are doing terrible things to our environment, directly impacting the sports that they're then sponsoring.
You used the word dirty when you were talking about the companies that are putting money in, but sport has immense social capital, positive health impacts. That makes it attractive to companies that do want to be seen in a positive light. And sport needs sponsors, doesn't it? That's not going to change anytime soon.
No, it isn't going to change. And at the moment, a lot of that is coming from massive national state-owned fossil fuel sponsors. But it's not a deal that sport can accept for much longer. Those are the exact same companies that are causing the climate crisis at the moment and are going to make pitches flooded. They're going to make it too hot to run races.
What's the alternative? Do you think other companies can bring in the same sort of money to sport?
I absolutely think they can. The Paris Olympic Games was an absolute triumph this summer, and that was a completely fossil fuel-free Games. They've shown it's possible, and I think with the building momentum among athletes, among players, and also from the general public, they don't want to see dirty sports. They want to see us playing clean, and we can't really hold ourselves to those values unless our sponsors reflect them as well.
The timing of this report is interesting after such a big summer of sport, but sport's viability is being challenged by flooding, storms. We've just had the warmest summer on record across the planet, according to the Copernicus Climate Change Service. Are you concerned certain sports or events won't have a long-term future?
I'm rowing out of one of my local rowing clubs at the moment, and at the start of season meeting, it was literally discussed up front that the likelihood of flooding is so high and the amount of rowing is going to be small, so get on the water as soon as you can because you might not be able to later. It's grassroots sports that are affected the most, disproportionately so from the high-performance sport, and it really is an existential threat being able to do grassroots and elite sport across the world.
And what can athletes do, apart from use your voice, use your platforms, what more can you do?
Whether it's sustainability or whether it's a different cause, athletes are the perfect role models to try and push these forwards. And I think for us, we need to say no to fossil fuels. We need to say no to these dirty sponsorships.
There's also the issue of travel. It's one of the trickier issues of events. There are athletes, there are fans, the media, one-off souvenirs being made. An Olympics that you've just been at and won a gold medal at isn't an Olympics without some of those aspects, is it?
That is true, but when you look at the fact, 80% of global carbon emissions are caused by the fossil fuel companies. And just like in sport, when you work together to achieve something as a team, you can achieve something that's greater than the sum of those parts. And I think the Paris Olympics inspired not only sports people, but also companies showing that you can run it without fossil fuels. And so I think we can move towards a fossil fuel-free world.
Imogen Grant, Paris Olympic rowing champion and doctor. And tomorrow I'll be talking to a couple of Bens, Olympic sailing champion Ben Ainslie, and one for you, Amal cricketer Ben Duckett, ahead of England's one-day international series against Australia.
Fantastic. He's a wonderful player. Carthy, thank you very much indeed. Coming up in just about 28 minutes' time, it'll be More or Less. And here's Tim Harford to tell us more.
We're told that 9,500 millionaires will leave the country this year because of Labour's tax policies, which raises the question, how would anyone go about figuring that out? Our listeners told us we missed the point with last week's fact check about the benefits paid to asylum seekers. Well, perhaps we'll take aim again this time. We don't generally endorse gambling, but if it's two policy wonks making a bet about who's right, we are here all day for that. And what does a string quartet teach us about the woes of the National Health Service? That's More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds in half an hour.
Looking forward to it. Always am, actually. 26 minutes to nine, a look at the weather. This morning, any areas of mist and fog and low cloud in southern and central parts will tend to break up and clear. I'd love to be able to give you that reassurance. It will then be a dry, sunny and warm day.
That is reassuring. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. It's 26 minutes to nine. Here's a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The Lebanese militant group Hezbollah says its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, will make an unscheduled address tomorrow after its members were targeted in simultaneous attacks. At least nine people were killed and thousands wounded when their pagers exploded yesterday. The United Nations, the US and the UK have called for restraint. Ben Rhodes, who served as President Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor, told us only Israel could have carried out the attack, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was ignoring the Biden administration, which has been urging Israel to avoid escalation. Israel is yet to comment. More than 120 international charities have called on the government not to reduce overseas aid in the budget next month. Foreign aid currently amounts to less than 0.6% of the UK's expenditure. At the general election, Labour promised to return it to 0.7% when circumstances allow. Official figures for last month show the annual rate of inflation has remained unchanged at 2.2%. The Office for National Statistics says higher airfares have been offset by the lower cost of fuel, restaurants and hotels. The American maker of food storage containers, Tupperware, and some of its subsidiaries have filed for bankruptcy. The company has been struggling with falling sales because of cheaper competition.
Jane, thank you so much. It's 25 minutes to nine. All this week, we've been hearing stories brought to us by Today Programme listeners. That's you. This morning, our listeners are Dr. Lisa Wright and Dr. Mark Walton, both clinical psychologists who work on Merseyside in the only NHS unit of its kind, where they're trying to cut criminal offending rates using therapy. It's not an alternative to prison. The NHS Forensic Psychology Centre in Liverpool works with people who have served custodial sentences who might be at risk of re-offending. But uniquely, the unit also works with families in the community to stop new parents who might be at risk of serious offending from committing crimes. Our Home and Legal Affairs correspondent Dominic Cassiani visited the NHS Forensic Psychology Centre, and this is the first time that they've allowed journalists in to see the work they do.
I'm outside Liverpool Crown Court. Few courts in the country dish out more justice than this rather intimidating piece of brutalist architecture, just a seagull's swoop from the Mersey. Today there are 17 courts running at full pelt. We've got three defendants up for possession of weapons, a few for assaults, threats to kill, two alleged robbers, two suspected arsonists, and six people facing a variety of sexual offences. This is the tide of violence and human misery that's not unique to Merseyside.
This court and courts around the northwest really a complete wide range of offences, to be honest.
Isabella Denwhite is 3 years into her career here as a barrister.
You come into court and see a really horrible offence, but then when you speak to a defendant and you often learn of the really tragic upbringing they've had, often things could be tackled to do with their life that may help stop them either committing those offences or committing any offence in the future.
Listening to the grim tales of criminals in courts is my bread and butter, but I'm not here for that. I'm in Liverpool to meet two Today listeners who want to show us their work in crime prevention.
Hello.
Hi, it's Dominic from the BBC.
Hi. It's Lisa, isn't it?
Yes.
Dominic, hi.
Hi, Dominic.
Nice to meet you. I'm Mark.
I'm Dr. Lisa Wright. I'm a consultant clinical psychologist and the service lead for Mersey Forensic Psychology Service, which is part of Merseycare NHS Foundation Trust.
I'm Dr. Mark Walton. I'm also a consultant clinical psychologist and I'm the clinical lead for the mental health treatment requirements across Merseyside and Cheshire.
Okay, so this is one of our consulting rooms or therapy rooms. This is where people have psychological therapy, usually one-to-one and usually weekly sessions.
For 30 years, this clinic has worked with ex-offenders in the community. Their clients include people convicted of violence and serious sexual crimes. For the last 6 years, they've expanded to include people who haven't yet offended. It's the only NHS prevention service of its kind.
The overall aim for all our clients is to prevent them either first time offending or re-offending.
Working with habitually violent or sexual offenders is difficult. Dr. Wright says her team looks at traumas suffered in childhood that have damaged an adult's thinking.
If you imagine a child growing up in a home or in a care home where they don't feel safe, imagine them being beaten up regularly by a parent. A common theme that we hear is that as the child gets older and they grow bigger, there comes a day where they fight back. So in that moment, they've learnt that the way I can feel safe is by attacking other people. And in their mind, it becomes a thing of two options where they feel like I'm either vulnerable, weak, hurt, or I'm strong, dominant, safe. They take that forward into adult life and into adult interactions. So therapy then is about helping them to realise that there's a middle ground, that instead of one extreme or the other, that they can learn how to feel safe without hurting other people.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for your understanding smile. And thank you for taking the time and to listen for a while. I thought you'd think I'm selfish.
In the clinic's office, there are cards from the men and women who they've helped. And this poem from a client whose offending was linked to drugs.
I now feel like a toddler who's first learning their ABCs. You have given me the tools to lift myself up from my knees. You have given
the hardest part of their work is reaching potential sex offenders.
So we have posters, we have leaflets in GP surgeries.
How many people are coming to you via that?
The numbers are lower than we expected. We've only had about 20 people since we launched in 2018.
You know, clearly some people are scared of coming forward, but what would you say to them to make them think differently?
We've worked with people who have changed and who have lived healthy, meaningful lives and have made really bold changes in their life and offer that as a message of hope and that we're willing to try. We're willing to try and work with them.
All right, I'm now recording.
So, Harry, and just for the tape, we're not going to use your voice. How did you first come into this clinic?
I wanted to come here when I first heard about the therapy to reduce my risk of reoffending and to live a normal life. I knew I was ready to commit to do to it and complete the course, but I was quite scared to say things I had never really said before about my childhood.
Harry, not his real name, voluntarily came in after serving a sentence for sexual abuse. He too had been abused. Since completing therapy 8 years ago, he's not offended.
Now I've got a job, I'm not waking up overnight, I can sleep properly, I've got no intrusive thoughts about children. I understand that it's a really, really bad offence and it should never have happened.
I suppose just locking somebody up isn't going to change what's made them offend. So if they're going to be re-released at some point, then we need to know that they are going to be safer when they're released.
A lot of people take the view that prison works. You lock people up, they can't commit a crime.
But that approach is waiting until people have committed a crime and created a victim and caused damage and pain and distress that might affect someone's whole life, and then locking them up. Why can't we use what we know works with people earlier on so they don't go to create that victim?
The impact of Mersey Care's programme is difficult to quantify, but Lisa Jones of Liverpool John Moores University has figures for the costs of doing nothing.
We estimated that the costs of violence in Merseyside are around £200 million, so quite a substantial amount of money.
£200 million a year?
£200 million, yes, within 1 year.
Who's bearing the biggest burden there? How do these costs break down?
For the police and criminal justice system, we saw £143 million. For the healthcare system, it was £33.5 million. And in terms of lost productivity, that effect of people either missing work or having to take time off work, it was £32.9 million.
I just want to make sure you know how much you have helped me. You have had
the support has been good to bring up my confidence. It's helped me to become a good dad and better partner. Absolutely amazing.
More thank yous. Cards sent to Dr. Lisa Marsland of Liverpool's Babs therapy programme. She works with new parents at risk of offending.
There's a mum with white hair and she's one of our volunteers now. And she had every risk, adversity under the sun that, you know, probably could have ended up with Lisa's forensic service. In a sense, she had a tag when she was pregnant, poor mental health, domestic violence, and with the right support at the right time, you know, to help her have that bond and attachment and separate out those issues from her son, who she loves and adores. She's testament really to how many of our vulnerable families can break through difficult times and can break cycles. In Babs, our ethos is there's no such thing as hard to reach families. They're not just going to turn up at a clinic. They're not just going to respond to a text message when they've got no credit on the phone. If you invest more in prevention, early intervention, services like Babs, you won't need to build more prisons. You won't need to build another kind of Ashworth hospital, because you're supporting very vulnerable families at the earliest opportunity to break those cycles.
Dr. Lisa Wright and Dr. Mark Walton argue now is the time for government to grasp this nettle.
What the public want generally from sentencing is for people to be less likely to go on and offend again. And I guess our ethos is very much in line with that.
What kind of results have you had with your service users?
They will constantly tell you that they've developed some element of personal growth.
So people can change, but they can also change before they've actually committed an offence.
If we looked at how much it costs, and if someone commits a crime, how much it costs to investigate them, to arrest them, to go through a trial, to get put in prison, how much it costs for the victim to get help for mental and physical problems, I think you might find that it's cheaper to invest in prevention.
Well, that was Dominic Casciani reporting, and thank you so much to our listeners, Dr. Lisa Wright and Dr. Mark Walton, for their contribution. One of the things we try and do on this programme is bring our listeners together with people who are actual experts in the field as well. And Andy Cook is HM Chief Inspector of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue, also former Chief Constable of Merseyside Police, and has joined us in the studio. Andy, good to see you.
Good morning.
What's your instinctive reaction to what you just heard? I could see you were listening very, very intently.
I think your contributors there have explained it perfectly about the importance of prevention and identifying those underlying causes that lead to offending behaviour. I mean, prevention and rehabilitation are equally massively important. And we heard the economic costs of it there just on Merseyside, £200 million was the cost. Across the country, obviously, it's much, much bigger than that. But prevention has always been a difficulty for policing because, firstly, during the austerity period when resources were cut. It didn't just affect policing, but social services, youth, national health and others. So some of the good work that was going on to address underlying issues and that prevention right across the system became harder and harder to do. But we've got to get back to a position where prevention, which is the most important thing for policing, but it's not just a policing issue.
I was going to say, it's an age-old debate, which I know you're close to and you've thought about for decades, actually, which is most people who commit these crimes are poor. And what we heard about there really was 8 minutes, Dominic Casciani reporting, it was a chronicle of poverty. Mm. There's an age-old question. What should you address? Do you address poverty or do you address the consequences of poverty?
It's a very good question. When I left my role as Chief Constable of Merseyside, I gave a media interview where I said that the most important way of preventing crime is to reduce poverty and increase opportunity. And that hasn't changed. I mean, it's pointless just putting money into policing to prevent crime. It's got to go right across the system. And there's got to be that join-up across government to actually address the issues, because National Health Service, Youth Services, Social Services, local authorities and police need to work together at an early age to address some of these issues. It's difficult to measure the benefits of prevention sometimes, but everyone instinctively knows it's absolutely the right thing to do. And I am encouraged that this government is looking to introduce young futures hubs to really start addressing, before people commit offences, the underlying issues that cause so much crime.
But one of the other things the government's had to do, they would say, their position is that they've had to release some prisoners early because of the situation in our prisons. And there are lots of people, in fact, including Sir John Major, who I was speaking to about this subject, lots of people who say there are too many non-violent people going to prison. Do you think that the phrase, the ethos around the idea that prison works, which is going back some decades now, do you think it's distorted how we think about prevention in this country?
It has. I mean, prison only works for the period of time that those individuals are in prison.
And it doesn't work if they come out and they're more likely to commit crimes afterwards.
Absolutely. So prison without rehabilitation, and a lot of work going on around rehabilitation while prisoners are in the prisons, is not a long-term strategy for success at all. So, and, you know, we've heard from the Chief Inspector of Prisons about prisoners being locked up for 23 hours, no rehabilitation work going on. It's an issue right across the criminal justice system. That join-up needs to be there between all the different agencies to ensure that we actually start making progress in this. We continue to reduce crime by actually intervening with people, usually at a younger age, to prevent them going down that path of criminality.
All right, Andy, very good to speak to you. I see you've put a lot of thought and time into this over the years and hope we can talk to you about it again. Andy Cook, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is the end of an era, I can tell you, at 12 minutes to nine. Tupperware Brands has just filed for bankruptcy. That's the official name of the company. The firm which makes the plastic containers beloved by cooks and I suppose quite many people in however they come to needing to store food, reportedly has more than $700 million in debt. Angela Hartnett, Michelin star chef, restaurateur and Tupperware fan. Is that right, Angela?
Yeah, I suppose I am a Tupperware fan.
I've never introduced you like that before. Good morning. but here we are together. What was your response, though, when you hear this? Because I suppose it's one of those brands and, you know, it's one of those words because it's become the thing that it is, that you just think will go on forever in some ways.
Yeah, and I think it's become generic with anything plastic in a kitchen. You know, I mean, I'm sure I look in my kitchen, there's probably maybe Tupperware, but otherwise it's plastic containers that you can reuse and reuse, but you all call it Tupperware because that's what you all think it is. And I think, it's a shame, really, because I think, one, it's obviously tragic for the people losing their jobs and livelihoods, but as well, I think it's something, given that we're all about sustainability and reusing stuff, it's a great thing to have because you do reuse it. You know, it's not having to cover stuff with cling film. It's not having to cover stuff with foil that you get rid of. You know, this stuff can go on forever. So I'm quite surprised that it has gone. But I was reading about it, as you say, online, and you can see it's the level of costs going up, transportation, use of raw materials, and that's what's done it for them.
Is that a pet that's got a view in the background?
That is Betty Boo in the background. We cover her dog food in Tupperware, in a Tupperware container.
Do you? Okay, well, important bits of detail about how you're storing anyone's food, pet or human.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, the move away from cling film, I don't know if that's like that in commercial kitchens, but and going, yes, hello, and going towards, I don't know, is it going towards glass? What's the trend?
Well, not so much glass. What it is going towards plastic containers and reusable lids, you know. So there's definitely a trend to not use as much cling film because it's one use of plastic. So lots of people, you know, Luke, who runs Limewood Kitchen down in the Hampshire, you know, he started this and basically stopping it in his kitchens. And basically you're buying plastic containers and putting lids on, and therefore you can reuse them. So glass is not recommended because obviously if something breaks, you know, then you've got glass everywhere and it's dangerous. But plastic is brilliant in that sense that you can reuse it and reuse it.
And just looking at the history of the firm, I mean, as you say, it's become a synonymous word with all food storage containers. But the company founded in 1946 by Earl Tupper, who patented the container's flexible airtight seal, and became well known in the 50s and 60s when people, and I'm going to go for it, women probably largely, held Tupperware parties to sell these containers. Have you ever been to a Tupperware party, Angela
Hartnett?
No,
I can't say I have, Emma Barnett, have you?
No, I haven't lived. Shall we throw one?
We should, yeah, because I love, you know, the other thing I sort of think, I always think about Tupperware is you see it come up in so many programs like sitcoms or, you know, comedies. You know, I always remember Modern Family, everyone arguing. There was a thing about arguing about someone's taking my Tupperware container. Because I think people feel very personal about
it. Oh, yes.
You know, because they can put their Christmas cake in it and they use that every year and it's that same container that seals it. So, you know, people do get, you know, I do ask for my Tupperware and plastic back when I give things out, I have to say.
Do you get it back, though? That's like lending a book.
I do. I do get it back. Cause
well,
I
wouldn't not give it back to you.
Well, that's very kind. Well, I think also because I think in the premise that if they give it back, they're going to get more. So that sort of works. And, you know, and now I've got a lovely little niece. I make all her food in little Tupperware containers. So it is a shame, actually, that it's gone.
That's when it entered my life on another scale. I have tried to use the more eco options and I've still got a couple of those around. But when I had a child, I suddenly realised I had one bit of Tupperware I think I'd been using since university, and I needed to up my game. But they did all fall out on me the other day because I just shove them in. I'm not very neat. Angela, though, good to talk to you and to the dog.
I think we all do that. All right, and you. Thanks.
I feel a bit better about it. Angela Hartnett there, how she does it, even for the dog.
Indeed. 7 minutes to 9. Right, we're going to end the programme with an absolute treat today because we've got some Sikh devotional music. It's played by, we're going to first speak to a father and daughter and explain the reason why we're doing it. And then we're going to hopefully hear a bit before the end of the programme if all the mics in this studio do what they're meant to do. It's going to be fine. It's going to be great. The reason we're doing this is that sacred Sikh music, known as Kirtan, has now become part of the universal 8-grade music examination system in this country. And that means that 5 beautiful Indian string instruments, the Dilruba, Taos, Esraj, Sarangi and Saranda, have I got that? Yeah, can be studied. And if you achieve grade 6 to 8, you can receive UCAS tariff points, which can go toward entry requirements for UK universities. And one of the instigators of this, one of the men behind this change, is Dr. Harjinder Lali, who led the development of the exam grading system. In his day job, as it were, he's a lecturer at Warwick University in cybersecurity, and we're going to speak to him and hopefully also Nanaki Lali, his 13-year-old daughter, who's been learning to play the sarangi since she was 5 years old and also sing with it. Dr. Harjinder and Nanaki, good morning.
Good morning.
It's lovely to have you guys with us. Why was it important to you, Doctor, to get this accreditation?
Well, what we wanted to see was to get the recognition, rigour and value. So children are learning these instruments, they're learning how to sing, but they're not getting the recognition. And it was really important that we set something up that would get them that recognition. And as far as the rigour is concerned, set something up that tutors can apply rigorously and give them kind of staged learning and give them a kind of sense of progression.
And what kind of reaction have you had to this news, both within the Sikh community and beyond?
It's been phenomenal. So we're sitting here at the BBC studios today, but we've also been contacted by schools in India. We're launching it in Baltimore, Seattle and Houston. So it's kind of gone all around the world pretty quickly within a week.
Wow.
It's only been a week since
we launched it. And how important is it to you that the next generation, including girls like your daughter, are playing these instruments?
Well, it's part of our cultural heritage, it's part of our faith, and we want to preserve this. And I think one way of doing that is to give them that recognition that, you know, we're going to get something out of this in the end. And to top it all off, obviously, the UCAS recognition is is kind of, you know, yeah. You couldn't get any better than that, really.
Is your lovely 13-year-old daughter Nanaki there? Are you there, Nanaki?
Yes.
Hello, good morning. So you play the sarangi. Just tell us a bit about that instrument and how hard it is to play.
The sarangi is super hard because you have to be able to find the pitch on it without having any frets, and you have to be able to bow in a straight line, and you have to sing at the same time. So it's super hard.
I think there are a lot of people who don't actually know what any of that means, so it sounds very hard. How often do you practice, Nanaki?
Well, me and my dad practice every day at like 7-ish for half an hour. So.
Every day?
Yeah.
In the night? It's 7 o'clock in the evening or before school? Not before school, surely?
No, after school, yeah.
Okay, and you enjoy it though, don't you? This is a nice time to play, you know, quality time with your dad, and also it's enjoyable to play, right?
Yeah, I really enjoy it.
Okay, and what would you like to do when you're older, Nanaki?
I want to be a dentist.
You want to be a dentist? Why do you want to be a dentist?
Because... Cool.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a dentist. It's a fantastic profession, but just it's interesting. Why do you want to do that?
Because my mum's told me about how, like, there's a shortage of dentists, and I've always been interested in medicine and, like, the medical side of things. So I've always differed between, like, being a doctor and being a dentist.
Okay, that sounds like a very, very cool choice. I mean, there is a bit of a shortage. We often talk about it on this programme. And just from your point of view, Nanaki, how cool is it, how important is it that these amazing instruments and the culture they're part of is now recognised in this formal way?
I think that it's really great because I'm going to start applying to uni in quite a few years away, but that will really help me, and it will also help a lot of other young girls and young boys get closer to their religion and faith.
And hopefully get into universities with these qualifications as well. Well, Nanaki, best of luck with all that you're doing and best of luck with your wonderful path to dentistry. I think we all need you to go into dentistry because the nation's teeth need it. And congratulations to your dad as well, Dr. Harjinder Lally. We're going to end the programme with a live demonstration of this music. We've got in the studio Avtar Singh, who's a Taos player from the Namdhari community. I hope I've said that correctly, Avtar. You've got this extraordinarily beautiful instrument next to you. I'm not even going to pretend to describe it, but it's wonderful, and people can look it up online. And please, as we go to the close of this show, I should just quickly tell you that our editors were Joshua Searle and Hannah Wilkinson. The studio director was Pete Wise. Tim Harford is up next with More or Less. But before that, here is Avtar Singh playing the Taos.